All right, the Health and Human Service Reform Committee will come to order. We do have a quorum, so Representative Sandstead moves the minutes from Tuesday, March 7th, 2017. Are there any additions, changes, corrections to be made to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the minutes from Tuesday, March 7th, 2017, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and the minutes from Tuesday, March 7th, 2017 are adopted. We have Representative Bennett with us this morning for the bill, again, members, that we took testimony on last week. There were a couple of changes, so we didn't move the bill out of the committee. We have those changes in front of us today, represented, and I will move that House File 986 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Representative Bennett, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Always good to be in front of your committee.
We have the A2 amendment. I will move the A2 amendment. Representative Bennett, 2-year amendment.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the A2 amendment just removes, if you remember, the auto insurance portion of this. Needs some more work. I'm going to work with HHS and other groups to get that right before we bring it back eventually. So that section is being removed for now.
Are there any questions to the A2 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Any final words, Representative Bennett?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm just going to encourage the committee to vote for this, and I won't take your time any further because you've already heard about it.
With that, I'll renew my motion that House File 986 be, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 986, as amended, is referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Thank you, Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
All right. I don't see Representative Scott in here just yet, so we'll move to Representative Fenton. And as Representative Fenton makes her way up, I will move that House File 547 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Representative Fenton, welcome to the committee. We have the bill in front of us. 2-year bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House File 547 would transfer the responsibility for the Child and Adult Food Care Program, CACFP, from the Department of Education to the Department of Health. This program is a federally funded program through the U.S. Department of Agriculture. So the funds are provided to child care centers, family child care homes, after-school programs, homeless shelters, and adult daycares to help them afford healthy food. From state to state, it's varied in which agency administers the program. In some, it is under the Department of Education. In other states, it's administered through Department of Agriculture, the Department of Health, or the Department of Human Services. One of the most important things is to look at how we can make sure that as many children, homeless, and adults in need have access to healthy meals. The Department of Health seems like a good fit. Healthy food access is the core mission of the MDH. Yeah. They already administer complementary programs such as Women, Infants, and Children, WIC, Statewide Health Improvement Program, SHIP, and Minnesota Breastfeeding Coalition, Family Home Visiting, and the Nutrition Assistance Program for Seniors. You will hear from people today that are for and against this bill. I'm going to say change is hard. The Department of Education has been doing this since 1978, but sometimes we need to take a step back and ask ourselves, is the same old status quo what is best for our Minnesota citizens in need of healthy meals? We have an aging population, and they're the least served under this program. What is the MDE doing to reach out to adult care programs to encourage them to participate? Is the CACFP underutilized in Minnesota? Who are we leaving behind due to bureaucracy? This right here, this stack, is the application for the Minnesota through the Minnesota Department of Education. This is an application for a sponsor and an application for a center in the state of Colorado. They are both bound by the same federal standards. So who can get through? What happens here in Minnesota? The smaller entities, the smaller homes, daycare provider homes, the smaller adult care provider homes cannot get through that. You end up with the people who have excess staff on top, such as the bigger corporate daycare centers and whatnot. So who is getting left behind? My intent With this is not to cause a disruption for sponsors or departments, but to serve as many who qualify for the nutritious meals. So this is not the first time we've had a discussion as to how the Department of Education has handled administrative responsibilities for this program. And it's time to have a fresh perspective. With that, I will turn it over to someone who is operating the CACFP in multiple states and is on the board of directors for the National CACFP Forum, Christine Twait.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Twait. If you can please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Mr. Chair, I'm Christine Twait. I'm the Executive Director of Partners in Nutrition. We're a nonprofit agency that is working in multiple states with a mission to increase healthy food access. One of the ways we do that is to help programs sign up for the USDA Child and Adult Care Food Program, CACFP. And I'm here today to tell you about how the CACFP in Minnesota is broken. So it's easy to think that the system is working because benefits are flowing. You may hear that Minnesota is 11th in the nation in participation in CACFP. However, that can be deceiving. That rate is high only because 84% of small family homes participate in the food program, and they're only able to do that because they're under the umbrella of a fiscal sponsor. And furthermore, 90% of family home providers participating in CACFP are white. The children and seniors that are being left behind with the CACFP under the administration of MDE are those that are attending independently run small programs. These programs lack the infrastructure to take on the bureaucracy that MDE has created. Even more unjust, children and seniors of color or from immigrant, refugee, or low-income communities are the ones without access to the benefits, and they're the ones that need it the most. My agency has tried to right this wrong. In the last year, we've helped 51 independent child care and adult daycare programs sign up for the CACFP. 96% of the seniors and youth from our programs are from minority groups, and 100% are from low-income households. Signing up for the CACFP has benefited these programs financially, but it's also revealed a state agency without fundamental and functional procedures to operate a federal program with culturally insensitive employees and an obsessive and myopic focus on compliance that discourages participation. Another argument you might hear is that the program is difficult to operate, and I'm here to tell you that MDE is making it harder than it has to be, and I'm speaking from experience. This is our application to be a fiscal sponsor in Minnesota. This is one application for one of our 51 centers in Minnesota. This is our application to be a fiscal sponsor in Colorado. This is our application for a site in Colorado. This is an abstract. This is real. Remember, same federal program, same federal regulations. I understand that there might be costs incurred in transferring the program from MDE, but increasing participation could actually recoup those costs. So a rough estimate is that Minnesota is missing out on $10.8 million federal dollars by keeping those programs from participating in the CACFP. That's just child care centers and after school programs in the 7-county metro. The real price tag is probably much higher than that. So in closing, I urge you to support this bill for the sake of Minnesota's at-risk seniors and youth.
Thank you, Ms. Twait, for your testimony this morning. Do you have any other testifiers?
Yes.
Representative Fenton.
We have Ali, it's Anand.
My name is Ali Ayal. I'm a owner and manager of Global Child Care Center. It is a child care center located in South Minneapolis. I'm testifying this because of my own experience and how I have to deal with MDE to get an approval of the food program. My center carries about less than 100 children, which are very low-income families and mainly immigrants, newcomers to the country. I applied a couple of times for getting the assistance of the food, and when I saw how difficult it is, I have to not go forward. But the need was greater. I did have to hire someone to help me to get this fruit, which I cannot even able to afford the expenses. I think it makes sense if the MD cannot deliver this, should move to other departments. The departments that we already deal with it, with already knows, like health department, that is already have an ability to carry this kind of a problem. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Ali. Mr. Ali.
All right. Do you have any other testifiers, Representative Fenton?
With that, I'm going to bring up Mr. Wadeed Watkins.
All right, welcome to the committee. Mr. Watkins, you please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, representatives. My name is Reefid Watkins. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Fagerty Baker Daniel. I'm sorry, I can't see half the people. Do you mind if I just shift this? I'm an attorney with the law firm of Fagerty Baker Daniels. I've been a litigator here in the state of Minnesota for over 8 years now. I'm here to testify about my personal experiences with MDE and in particular its relationship to CACFP. In all of my years, I have never seen such flagrant, repeated, and stubborn violations of federal law, state law, federal constitutional law, state constitutional law. I can, have, and will prove in a court of law that the Department of Education has violated federal law repeatedly. This is going to be easy to prove because the department has admitted as much. The department issued an opinion in one of my cases that it is violating every federal regulation under the entirety of the CACFP program. Nonetheless, it persists. So I persist. We are now engaged in two different lawsuits against MDE in this particular case. We expect to be paid on both of them. I expect to recoup not only actual damages, but attorney's fees for all of my time that MDE is forcing me to spend trying to get them to follow the simple, basic ordinance of the law. MDE has acknowledged its violations, and it continues to do so. I'm here to tell you that by the end of this year, I plan on filing two additional lawsuits against the Department of Education for violations of the federal constitution, for discrimination against minorities, discrimination against immigrants, and for violations of federal law as well. I expect the damages to be somewhere in the neighborhood of over $10 million over the course of these lawsuits. If the Department of Education is to continue operating this program, I'm here to make one request. You need to increase their budget. They've asked you for an additional $2 million a year. That's not even going to come close. If they are going to run this program, the damages that will result from their violations of federal law they have admitted to will far exceed that. This is a serious matter. The people of Minnesota deserve far better, and it shouldn't take a barrage of lawsuits for change to actually happen. Change belongs here with the legislators to make the real difference. People of Minnesota just deserve far better than this. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Watkins, for your testimony. Are there any questions for Ms. Twight, Ms. Egan, or Mr. Egan, or Mr. Watkins? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony this morning. Commissioner Corkett? Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Darren Cordy. I'm an assistant commissioner with the Minnesota Department of Education. I do have a handout, Mr. Chair, if there would be a page perhaps that could hand that out for us. I'll just leave it here.
It doesn't look like at the moment, but as soon as someone comes in, we'll get that.
Sounds good. It's there for you. Mr. Chair, members, the Department of Education does not support this bill for a number of reasons. And despite what you've heard today, we actually are doing a very good job running this program. Over the last 3 years, for child care centers only, we've had over 177 new child care sites come onto the program. That's a 26% increase. We've had 2.7 million more meals served. That's a 21% increase. We've had 4.8 million in new federal dollars brought into the program, which is a 35% increase. And that's in addition to the 8,500 participating licensed family child care homes we have in the state. Under the administration of MDE, the CACFP funds about 45 million meals each year to the tune of $56 million in federal funding. As you heard already, MDE ranks 11th in the country in total CACFP reimbursement received, and that's despite being only 21st in the country in terms of total population. That means we're outperforming 10 larger, more populous states in the country on total CACFP reimbursement.
Yeah.
And there was some conversation about our compliance with federal law. I'd just like to say we underwent our USDA management evaluation. That's something we have to do for CACFP every 3 years. Just went through it 3 months ago, and they found no major violations in any of our application or our application or review processes. Now, we've been seeing exponential program growth in this area. We would hate to lose momentum by having to divert time and resources to a lengthy and disruptive transition to another agency. I wanted to talk a little bit about our outreach, since that also came up. We have a number of different projects that we're working on to expand outreach to organizations that are in need. We've been partnering with an organization called Hunger Impact Partners to use data from several different agencies to identify and target areas of need throughout the state. We have a 10-year partnership with the Second Harvest Heartland to improve child nutrition access that targets organizations and schools for participation in both CACFP as well as the Summer Foods Program. I've been working with the University of Minnesota and a researcher there on a child care assessment study that will yield strategies for improving nutrition for feeding children, as well, which would include CACFP. Also wanted to touch on cultural competency since that was brought up. A little over a year ago, we brought in an external professional cultural competency trainer who performed an entire program training as well as individual one-on-one evaluations and trainings for every single one of our staff on cultural competency for CACFP. We have a Somali child care center owner who sits on our child nutrition advisory board. She advises our CACFP staff on ways to improve our training methods, our materials, and our overall approach when dealing with Somali child care organizations. We also have stakeholders from other immigrant communities that sit on this advisory board, and we work with all of them to ensure that their opinions are included in conversations on ways to improve child nutrition in Minnesota. It's just logical to keep CACFP at MDE. We've been administering the program since 1978. We have staff with an average experience of 10 years. We have staff with experience of upwards of 30 years. We have a 94% satisfaction rate with our existing sponsors. We administer every other child nutrition program that's offered by USDA, including school lunch and school breakfast program, the summer food program, special milk program, fresh fruits and vegetables program, and the USDA foods program. All of these different programs housed at one agency work together, and their staff work together to ensure that we're working toward the common goal of providing healthy and nutritious meals that improve academic outcomes. To separate CACFP away from all these other child nutrition programs is going to create gaps in efficiencies, gaps in coordination, gaps in research, and in strategic planning. And then last but not least, there's going to be a significant disruption for our existing sponsors when we undergo this transition. They know our systems. They know our they have relationships with our staff. They know who to go to if there's problems. Payments, if you submit a payment this week, you're going to get a check next week. We can guarantee that there's going to be delays in that process during the transition. It's possible some sponsors would drop out of the program entirely rather than deal with the headache of moving to another agency. And I know this is the policy committee, but I'd be remiss to not mention there would be significant unfunded financial implications for both MDE and the Department of Health. So I appreciate you allowing me to testify on this bill, and again, we just urge you to think twice about moving it forward.
Questions for Commissioner Corgi, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And looking at the material, it almost seems like you would be calling this the CCFP because I didn't hear anything about adult care.
That's a problem.
In it. And the other thing is, having been on, Ed Finance and been involved with some of the daycare providers, I'm aware that actually some of the federal dollars were handled by the Association of Licensed Daycare Providers. So they actually were doing a lot of the journeyman work on this, and that your agency actually has just about destroyed that organization, so they had to form a new organization by your meddling in it. And frankly, I'm not seeing any reason to justify allowing MDE to further affect the daycare providers and ignore a good portion of what this program is for. So I'm just really pleased, happy and proud that this legislation is going forward, and it's not too soon.
Commissioner Cordy.
Mr. Chair, you know, we do work closely with adult care providers. It's a much smaller segment of the population. It's about 170 total licensed providers throughout the state. The problem that many of them run into is that you're not eligible to participate in the CACFP unless you have an enrollment of over 25% of your enrollment is free or reduced price lunch eligible. So while there may be many that aren't participating, it could be because some of them aren't eligible to participate.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just curious, how many FTEs do you require to facilitate this program?
Commissioner Cordy.
I believe it's 9.75 FTE, but it's spread across about 11 people.
Representative Peterson. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple questions. So to the Commissioner, can you help us understand that application, please? That it seems just on its face to be outrageously significant.
Yep. Mr. Cordy. And Representative Murphy, thank you for asking. I didn't mean to break this up. You know, so I haven't seen that stack of paper. I don't know what's in there. But I can tell you, we went back, we looked at our application, our enrollment package for multi-site sponsors. We looked at the enrollment package for Colorado. And, I mean, this is what they look like stacked up next to each other. And I'll leave them here for folks to take a look. They're very similar. We also took a look at the processes that are required by each state. And actually, Colorado has two additional state requirements for the program that exceed federal requirements that we don't have. So to that extent, we actually require a little less than what Colorado does.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then to Representative Benton, I have to confess that I once worked at the Department of Education. It was called the Department of Children, Families, and Learning when I worked there, and it was shortly after a merger between a variety of agencies to try and focus more on child care, or child well-being and education, which was a good idea, but was, I think, very challenging to execute inside the bureaucracy, and it gave me a real taste for what happens and what doesn't happen inside our state agencies. The question I have for you is, what I understand your motivation, but what guarantee do you have for us that by moving this function to the Department of Health, that the program will be operated differently or better or more efficiently, and that we would get to the goal that you're describing?
Representative Benton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy. The Department of Health is already also operating similar programs in this area. It's one of their core missions for nutrition. But here's the thing. I think you mentioned 45 million meals. Out of the 45 million meals, only 212,000 are going to serve our adult care. And I think by moving it to Department of Health, we could better assess and serve everybody. And you don't have to take from children to increase the number of meals that you serve to adults. We are leaving a lot of opportunity to serve this aging population on the table. And in my hope is that as it transitions, that they look at the whole big rounded picture of children and adults.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Fenton, I mean these questions not as a challenge, but to understand. So in my experience, when I saw functions transferred from one agency to another, it didn't really result in the outcome that I think the legislature at that time was seeking to achieve. And I know that the legislation in front of us says, let's transfer this function from one place to another because the other place is doing it and doing it differently, and so therefore hopefully better. But in your conversations with the Department of Health, do you have a sense that their bureaucracy will be less, it'll be more effective? I'm hearing from your testifiers they want to see that move, but it is hard for us to manage a bureaucracy from here, right? We set policy. So I just want to know you're thinking a little bit more about the actual effectiveness of the program if it's delivered by a different part of the state bureaucracy.
Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Murphy, my hope is that when you have a fresh set of eyes and fresh perspective that can look at this and change up the status quo, that you have improved results.
Representative Murphy.
I think I'll leave it there, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question kind of follows with the line of questioning Representative Murphy had. I'm just wondering if somebody here from the Department of Health who could speak to this, I'd just be interested in hearing their thoughts on the agency's ability to administer this program, what sorts of similar programs the agency has experience administering, and so forth.
All right, and I think we have someone here to help you with that. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Meg Adebel. I'm the director of the Community and Family Health Division at the Minnesota Department of Health. We, in my division, manage the WIC program and the CSFP, the Commodities Special Food Program, administered by USDA. I think to echo what Commissioner Cordy said, we actually don't have any experience in this particular program that's administered by USDA. The WIC program is quite different. We give grants to about 57 entities, community health boards, tribes, and CAP agencies around the state. They, in turn, have about 300 clinics where they serve directly pregnant and breastfeeding women and kids up to age 5 with nutrition counseling, and then provide vouchers so that they can go to their local grocery store and get a special package of food. My understanding of this program is that it directly reimburses child care entities for their costs for providing foods within the child care setting. It's a different data and electronic management system that we have under WIC. I think that it would, again, require, I think our concern on the part of the Department of Health is that because we don't have experience managing this program, it would take a while for us to gain that experience, and the concern is related to a potential interruption in services to child and adult care centers.
Representative Freiberg.
I'll just think about that for a while.
All right. As long as we have her up here, are there any other questions for Ms. Duvall? Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So has the Department of Health worked with, have you worked with the Department of Education? Have you, I know that you're not going to be able to tell me about conversations you necessarily had, but it is very hard, I think, for us to try and improve a program by trying to direct the management of the program. And by just moving it alone, I'm not confident that we're going to improve the program. And it sounds like there are some issues, Representative Fenton, that you're raising that are important for us. And so while I understand and appreciate and support your goal, without the cooperation within the agencies to make this work, I'm worried that we won't achieve the outcome that you're trying to achieve by just moving it from one department to another department. And so I think as this bill travels, it is going to be important for the Department of Health and the Department of Education to find some common ground about the goal with your leadership guiding them. Because I think we could pass this law and not see any change or an improvement for people that you're hoping to serve.
Response to that?
I absolutely thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy. There are some serious problems with this, and in this legislation, absolutely, we will be following through to make sure those of diverse communities, low-income communities, and adults are more properly served. I would hope that agencies can use shared resources to have better outcomes. So these are some things that I think can happen in a transition.
Follow up, Representative Murphy. Mm-hmm. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Fenton, I admire your desire to
want to allow this program to be more effective and to serve more of the populations that you spoke about. But in your process of putting this bill in this language together, did you take the time to reach out to the Department of Health?
Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Moran, I did have a meeting with Department of Health. They were going to look at it and get back to me. I did not hear from, I got an email from them late in the night before the very first hearing. But Department of Education took time to go meet with Department of Health and let them, and I question whether they encouraged them to not get behind this. I don't know that. But they, too, took time to meet. And again, I think we seriously need to look at how we can improve our underserved, what we're leaving on the table, the underutilization of this program. And I think we need to look at shared resources and other ways in the transition.
Representative Moran.
Mr. Chair. I think often enough when we have aspirations to see better outcomes, that you know, we find ways to make that happen. But what I've also seen is that often enough, you know, one of the things that I heard from the Department of Education was that they've been doing this for a while, right? And they have coordination, they are coordinating with other entities, they have the research, they have the outreach, and they have a relationship with those diverse communities and their board, which is really, really important. Because often enough, when we transition from one entity to the other, those relationships and contacts are lost. And often enough, what happens with the low-income community, the immigrant communities, the communities of color, those relationships are not there. So the outreach to those communities do not happen. And when they do happen, it takes years, right? Or the conversation is, well, we don't know where they are. We don't know where they're located. And that's the problem. Right? It is a problem because at the end of the day, it is those communities that are left out of the process so often. Relationships are important. Connections are important. And that is what moves a body to be more effective. So as we look at how we can help the Department of Education become more effective with the work that they're currently doing and doing well, I would ask that we consider that in the midst of, you know, trying to be helpful for those immigrant communities and communities of color, that we realize that there are relationships there that we can build on that will be lost because often they are. And that is, as they continue to do what they do, can do it well, which we clearly heard from the Department of Health. They do not have the experience. They do not have the relationships or the know-how to do this effectively. It takes time to build on that. It takes time. So I really respect your eagerness to want to serve those populations, but I also want to share with you, often enough when we transition, it is those populations that are left out of the process.
Representative Fenton, before you begin, there was a request by a couple of the members that if we could see the stack from your first testifier to just pass that around for us to take a look at as the discussion continues.
Wanted it passed around. You got the really strong guy.
No, we all have office jobs here.
I don't know if I get to respond to any of those, but I've got to talk from some of that.
Sure. All right, and yeah, the pages could just send out a couple of those. And then when you're ready, Representative Clinton, I apologize for that, to respond, you have the floor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and Representative Moran. As we heard, I don't know if you were here, had arrived yet, but as we heard from Mr. Ali, that whole segment is already being left out of this. And again, you know, I don't like it when agencies tell me that it's complicated, because who made it complicated as you're passing that stack around? It's complicated to me in this situation, translates to fewer children and adults, and specifically of low income and diverse populations being served. Now, both Minnesota and Colorado are held to the same federal standards. But as you see from the application of Colorado, they've chosen to streamline that process themselves to make it available to more people in need. And that is the goal. The number one goal is to make sure we serve more children and more adults in need.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I agree. And one of the main points that I just heard from your statement is that, you know, the process needs to be streamlined, right? And so I think that could be a request of the Department of Education, is to streamline the process and create a pathway so that more immigrants and communities of color and low-income communities can have access to the service that they provide. I agree. And so my hope is that we can leave out of here, you know, putting some fire on the Department of Education to do that.
Representative Sandstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is actually for the representative from MDE.
Commissioner Cordy.
Thank you. My question for you is, this bill seems to be largely centered around the concern that adult populations are not being served adequately. Of the FTEs that you mentioned exist currently within MDE, is there a position specifically addressing the adult population?
Mr. Cordy.
Mr. Chair and Representative Sandstead, no, the staff that work on the programs work on all of the programs. You know, we have some that, you know, have more expertise in one area or another, but we don't have a dedicated FTE just to the adult program. As I said, it's a relatively small segment of the population. We're talking 170 licensed centers compared with over about 1,700 child care centers, 8,500 family child care providers too. So again, it's an important piece of our work, and we're certainly trying very hard to increase that number, but the end size is pretty small.
Representative Sandstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My follow-up question is probably for both the author and yourself. Do you feel that this issue could be addressed by having a dedicated FTE?
Commissioner Cordy.
Mr. Chair and Representative Sandstead, I think that's something we could take a look at. You know, I'd want to, you know, chat with our director and our supervisor of the program and get their thoughts on it, since they're a little bit closer to the day-to-day work than I am. But that's certainly something we could take a look at.
Representative Fenton.
It depends on who the FTEs that they hire, but if, as we heard earlier, the multiple infractions of not abiding by federal and state law, that's sometimes you need to have a fresh perspective on the program in its entirety.
Representative Fenton.
Thank you.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the Department of Education, in regards to the adult daycare centers, can you talk a little bit about, you know, are there barriers to access? What are the barriers? What are the requirements for adult daycare providers?
Commissioner Cordy.
Mr. Chair and Representative Moran, as I said, we know the number of licensed child care centers, or adult care centers that are out there, but we don't actually know the number that are eligible to participate. You have to have a certain number of participants who are free and reduced price lunch eligible. So it could be that a number of those 170 don't meet that threshold and therefore wouldn't be eligible. Again, we don't collect that information, and DHS licensing doesn't collect that information. But you know, that doesn't mean that we don't target all of those licensed providers. And I won't deny that, that it is a complex program, and that the that the regulations that exist under it are you know, they're there, and there's there are things that can be difficult for small providers to keep up with. You know, we do our best to support them through our staff. We also have sponsors that work as intermediaries to help them through that process. So we are, you know, the process itself does have some barriers, but those are guided by federal regulations to prevent, you know, waste, fraud, and abuse. But we do have a number of structures in place to try and get through those barriers for those folks.
Representative Moran.
So some of the barriers are the federal regulations that doesn't allow many of those centers to qualify. So there's 170 adult centers, right? So the Department of Education is not able or does not do the outreach to the 170 plus centers. Who does?
Mr. Chair and Representative Moran, we definitely do outreach to those centers. It's a voluntary program. We can't force them to participate, but we do outreach to those centers.
Representative Moran.
And again, they have to be licensed centers as well. I'm sorry.
Representative Moran.
All right, thank you.
Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think this question might be directed to Ms. Twait. So looking at some of this stuff, how much of it is actually application versus tracking? Because looks like in this pile there's a lot of client personal information and tracking, and would any of that change if you were to transition it? Because it looks like this is just the application and that most of it is online. Is this because it looks like this was generated from an online system?
That's great.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. Yes, they have to submit 1 month of attendance in Minnesota. That particular application is from a center serving about 300 immigrant children from low-income communities. DHS currently requires one piece of paper per child for attendance records. So, yes, they have to copy all of that to be included into the packet. In Colorado, they are saying that it's they're going to verify it when they're at the center. They're not going to make you make a copy of every single one of those hundreds of pieces of paper and send it in with your application. That they're going to trust that you have correctly put everyone into the right category and that you know if your center has 25% of the children in a low-income household or not. So it's more of a it's a utilization of papers that exist for other purposes in Colorado and a place where we want you to look. Colorado's, and I will say also that Colorado, it is administered by the Department of Health, and I think that's part of why the experience has been so different for us in Colorado is it's always been about populations and how do we increase participation. And so they would verify that 25% on a site visit when they come and do an approval. They would go through that rather than requiring that as an upfront, send us all of these papers before you can even get in the door. I will also note that that is actually not considered the application by MDE. They consider that a pre-application. And so their actual application is through their computerized system. They hold the ability to issue user ID and passwords for that system. So what is happening to many of our centers in the community is they send in that giant piece of paper, and it takes MDE months to get back to that center. And when the center says, I thought that this was a 30-day regulation on applying for this program, they say, well, you haven't actually applied. That's a pre-application, and until you put it in our computer system that we hold the ability to issue user IDs and passwords for, you haven't actually applied. So we have centers that have waited 6 months, 8 months, 9 months just to apply for the program. So these are the kinds of things versus, again, Colorado saying you request a user ID and password, 24 hours later, you've got one. We're not playing games with pre-applications. We're not, you want an application for benefits for a federal program? Here you go. Welcome.
Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So to me, it sounds like it might just be an improved process that we could work on instead of a complete transition. I think that this might be overkill, but there's definitely ways that we could improve it instead of transitioning it and ripping the whole thing down and starting over. So I think maybe, you know, it might be more beneficial if we looked at improving how to get into this application system and not make it so cumbersome for the providers. But, you know, I think maybe that would be the direction to go instead of blowing it all up and starting over.
All right. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe I missed this. I don't know if this question is for Representative Fenton, but I thought that all of the contents of that box that we saw were characterized as sort of part of the application materials. I'm looking at, I got three of the binders that came around here. They seem like fairly reasonable training manuals. One of them is for the child care center director. You know, it just talks about like what sorts of food should be provided for different different age groups. One of them is the emergency shelter site lead training manual, so it doesn't seem like it's part of the application process. I'd also note that two of them are identical, so I mean obviously if you have two identical binders here, it adds to the thickness of the entire into the entire package, but these don't seem like part of the application process to me.
Representative Fenton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Freiberg, the stack is moving your way. You're not there yet. Thank you. Paper is moving your way.
If I could just make a comment on that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, in Colorado, this is part of the management plan. So in order to be a sponsor, you have to write a management plan. So those materials are part of what we had to submit as when they say, so Colorado would say, how are you going to train your staff? And we would say, oh, well, we're going to use, you know, the training materials that we developed based on federal regulations. In Minnesota, it's send me every single piece of paper that you're going to give to your centers, and we're going to review all of those pieces of paper and make sure it's death by a thousand paper cuts. And so instead of saying, you know what, if you're a sponsor, we're going to trust that you know what you're doing, that you are going to train according to these federal regulations, and we're going to monitor that on our compliance visits, it's a barrier to entry, right? This is not, having all of those pieces of paper is not accomplishing the goal of making sure, you know, that benefits are getting out to the community. It's making sure that the state agency feels safe, that there's lots and lots and lots and lots of papers there. And so it's a philosophical difference. And while I respect and support anything that is trying to get benefits out to the community, we've been trying to work with MDE on these, and I just don't know that an administration that is focused on education and schools and bureaucracy is ever going to be equipped to have that fundamental shift to focus on equity and participation.
Representative Flanagan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I participated in some of, through my previous employer, we did the summer food program, as well as had different federal grants with the Department of Education, and so I certainly understand the paperwork. I also just want to point out there's a lot of personal information on students in the forms that were being passed around, so maybe not such a great idea for us to pass those around. But a chunk of it, right, was attending sheets, and you know, and I understand the frustration with paperwork. I guess my question is, no offense to the, you know, to MDH, but I also know that lack of paperwork is not what they are known for. And so I guess my question is, what assurance do we have if we move it from MDE to MDH that the length of paperwork that needs to be filled out as well as just compliance, that goes away?
That's
great.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Flanagan. There is always going to be a certain amount of paperwork, right? So part of what I want to get at is the philosophy, the values of the state agency. Do they care most about compliance, paperwork, checking the boxes, or do they care most about health equity, about the communities that might be left behind? And so it can be, we're going to have paperwork. It's going to happen. But it's a matter of if you are, you know, it's a culture. And I think the culture at MDH is a better match for a program that's meant to be getting, you know, federal food assistance out to communities with special emphasis on communities in need. I think the education department does a great job with schools, and that's their, you know, that's what they know, and it's, and that is their world. It's a strange fit to have them trying to work with adult daycares, to try to have them working with child care centers, versus I think that the culture there is more focused, at MDH is more focused on health equity. It's something where when senior management looks down, the things they're paying attention to are we serving all of the communities that need these benefits? How are we treating, you know, individuals who want to participate in this program? I think at MDE the focus is, did we check all of the right boxes? I literally started a summer food service training program, and they told me I had to make an X from the lower left to the upper right in a meal count sheet for the summer food service program. I mean, that's not protecting program integrity. That's just bureaucracy.
Representative Flanagan.
So I guess my question, thank you, Mr. Chair. My question again is, what assurances do we have that this will actually change?
That's great.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I think that it might be worth looking at adding accountability measures to this. I don't know what that looks like. I think that this is a really good and rich conversation that we're having, and I'm really glad that all of us are focused on the benefits and are they getting to where they need to be. I'm on board with anything that's going to get, I care about this program, this child and adult care food program. I care. And so anything that gets, I'm sorry. Anything that gets the benefits out there, that's what matters. And so if we want to offer an amendment about the accountability measures, great. I am absolutely supportive of this. I just have been trying to work with the department, and it hasn't gone anywhere. They don't express a caring about the people, and I want that to change.
Representative Flanagan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your passion.
Okay.
It's great. And listen, you know, I've been on the receiving end of making sure that we, you know, check those boxes and have the sharing table and throw the food away that needs to, like, and so I definitely understand. And my question is simply that, you know, in order to ensure that young people, that adults, the people, as you've mentioned, right, are getting the most out of this program, that we have some type of just assurance or sense that it'll be a little different with MDH. So thank you for your work of making food more accessible for communities. And I, again, appreciate your passion. But my question still remains is that if we're going to make this transfer, that we need to ensure that it's for the result that we want will occur. So,
hello, Mr. Watkins.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, Representative. I think you're all asking exactly the right questions, and I appreciate them. I want to be very brief, but I do want to respond. What we have here, as Ms. Twait was talking about, is a very unique culture within MDE. The application process by law can only last 30 days. That's it. It's a 30-day process. That's the law. The Partners in Nutrition's application has been pending for over a year and a half. They've submitted all those documents you've seen and hundreds and thousands of pages more. MDE's response, I kid you not, we don't have enough information. We got before the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals asked the single and obvious question of MDE, what is the standard? What are you looking for? Why don't you have enough? The response from MDE, we don't know. We don't know what we're looking for. We don't know if we have enough. When asked, Partners in Nutrition has demonstrated millions, literally over $1 million in funding to satisfy a federal law that requires zero. Why isn't over $1 million to satisfy zero enough? The response from MDE, we don't know.
They didn't submit it in the right format. The judges literally laughed at this. And it's not funny. It's a year and a half of millions of dollars of federal funds not going to feeding the diverse and minority communities who need it the most. You want to know about assurances? We can't give you assurances that somebody else is going to do better. All I can assure you is that no one could conceivably do worse. This is set up deliberately to obfuscate the process, to prevent people who are minorities, to prevent people who are disenfranchised from getting this program. Mm-hmm. And you think I'm being overly broad on it? I'm not. I can prove this. I will prove it. I'm going to get a jury trial on this, and I'm going to prove this. We have numbers to show the percentage of people who are limited to. The other point I want to make is the pre-application process. That's an illegal process. MDE has admitted in its own internal process that a pre-application process is a violation of federal law. They've admitted that. They still do it. That's the culture. That's the philosophy that they have at MDE. That's illegal. It's disgusting. And it's a deliberate barrier to certain people's participation in that program. And I know the reaction has to be shocking to this, but we have the evidence on this. This is objective, provable facts. Look at the percentage of the participation in the communities. You ask, why aren't minority communities participating in a higher percentage? Because the application process is deliberately cumbersome, and it's a violation of state law, it's a violation of federal law. They're going to get reversed in the Court of Appeals, and they're going to get slapped by a jury in the next few months.
Thank you, Mr. Watkins. And Mr. Watkins, we would ask that any comments that move forward don't speak directly to court cases that are currently pending.
I apologize, but it is a court case currently pending. In fact, it's two court cases currently pending, and it is objective.
That's why we don't like to talk about those.
No, but they're objective evidence established on judicial record.
We understand, Mr. Watkins. Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, as a former child care provider, I totally understand bureaucracy of the food program. So my heart goes out to you. Speaking of the child care issue, that's pretty much controlled by the USDA and the federal government, but the paperwork there is ridiculous as well for providers. And if they miss counting a meal that day, let's say they get behind on paperwork and they don't get to that particular day where they're logging each individual breakfast, lunch, or snack, or dinner, and that food program lady comes by the next day and takes a look at the calendar to see who's been attending and what meals have been served. If they missed a day, that whole entire month is void, and they don't get payment at all. It is a bureaucracy on the entire food program, not just with the MDA issue, but the entire program needs an overhaul.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, we struggle a lot in this committee with these issues about how much regulation is good regulation, because we know that regulation a lot of times is protecting clients or it's protecting the state and protecting public money against misuse. And, of course, there is a point where that goes off the rails and it becomes regulation or bureaucracy for its own sake. And so there's always a very difficult balance to be struck. And I, you know, this is not an area that I'm familiar with. Some of you in the room have a lot more experience with this particular thing. But I've been listening to this and trying to sort it out and looking at the paperwork, and I have a suggestion. So I think that tomorrow is the deadline for suggestions to the Office of Legislative Auditor for program evaluations. The legislative auditor is often able to help us figure out what we need to do to a program to make it work better. And so I think this would be an ideal opportunity. It sounds like just the kind of thing that they would be good at, that if one member or more members could maybe, Representative Fenton, you'd be the perfect person. Put in it, you know, and then those of us here who have, you know, heard about it, you know, hopefully, I know Representative Quam is on the selection committee. I just heard that we're both on the OLA commission, but he's going to be on the selection committee for topics. So, you know, I would suggest that you put this in as a topic. It would just make so much more sense than taking the really big move of trying to move it to a different agency to be a little bit more surgical about the changes that are needed, to have the OLA say in a sort of objective and authoritative way what changes we should make to improve this, because none of us, first of all, none of us likes to think that our programs are stopping people from getting the help they need and that they're wasting anybody's money, least of all state money, right, taxpayer money. So if there's a lot of bureaucracy going on for bureaucracy's sake, that is helping no one. And so let's, you know, I think that would be a just a much better way to proceed than to proceed with the bill, while I understand the passion behind it and the desire to do something. And especially in light of the fact that there's a lawsuit pending, it doesn't really seem like this is a very good procedure. But I appreciate that sometimes people bring forward bills just to bring things to the attention of the legislature and to get some airtime, you know, and I appreciate that that you're certainly trying to do that. I'm not saying you're not trying to also get to a real solution, but I think if you put in right away, put in a request to the OLA, fill out that form that you got, that we all got, and if you don't have it, I'm sure it's online, or we can get another one for you. I don't think you even need to use the form. You can just write something down and drop it off at the OLA office, and I hope we could get a really good evaluation of what's going on here and some real concrete suggestions for fixing it.
Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 547? Seeing none, final question from members. Final word, Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members, and thank you for a very good discussion. Representative Liebling, I've already submitted my suggestion to this, have this program audited, but I do know the more that come in, the better the chance of it actually having precedent. So I encourage all of you, but thank you for the discussion, and remember, this is about getting as many children and adults in need served, and that's the number one goal of this, so thank you.
With that, I'll renew my motion on House File 547, be renewed to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails on House File 547, and be renewed to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Thank you, Representative Fenton. Representative Frankie. And members, just a reminder, I would like to try to for sure get House File 2047 Frankie and House File 1091 Hansen done before we have to leave for session this morning. Then we have House File 1362, Representative Scott, that will be heard this afternoon when we come back from recess. I know there's been some question on that. That will be heard this afternoon when we come back from recess. And then it looks like most of the rest of the bills are from members on the committee or Representative Zerwas, who is just everywhere. So with that, that's kind of the look ahead for the day. Representative Frankie, welcome to the committee. I will move that House File 2047 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. We have the bill in front of us. There is an A2 amendment, Representative Frankie. Do you want that amendment moved?
Yes, I would like to move the A2 amendment, Mr.
All
President.
Right, I will move the A2 amendment, Representative Frankie. And yes. Are there any questions to the A2 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A2 amendment, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A2 amendment is adopted. Representative Frankie, we have the bill in front of us the way you'd like it. To your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee, I appreciate hearing us this morning. I will try to be as brief as possible. House File 2047 is a comprehensive plan to end HIV and AIDS. What we are asking is that this bill directs the Commissioner of the Health to work with the Commissioner of Human Services and other stakeholders to develop a statewide comprehensive plan of priorities and actions to address the HIV and AIDS epidemic in Minnesota. In Minnesota, we've kind of leveled off at about 300 new cases every year. And the amount of money that is spent in battling this disease is about $400 to $400,000 over somebody's lifetime. As I heard my colleague, Representative Liebling, talk about last night. And the things that we can do to strategically figure out where do we best place our resources. So this is asking that it determines the levels of testing and care, services necessary to eliminate HIV, and specific initial outcomes that must be met. It provides recommendations on how to use existing funds to make the greatest impact and ensure a coordinated statewide effort. And it provides recommendations for new and enhanced interventions and additional resources needed for these interventions. It directs the commissioner to submit a report of the comprehensive plan and recommendations to the chairs and ranking minority members of the legislative committees with jurisdiction over HHS policy and finance by February 1st, 2018. So that's the gist of the bill. What that A2 amendment did was some language we worked on with the department that makes this an even better bill.
Really?
It works within existing funds and hoping to ask for no further FTEs on this, so everybody should love it. This is something I feel we need to do. I have some testifiers here with me. I have a dear friend of mine, Annie Elmer. She's also a constituent and a very big advocate in this area, and then Matt Tiburin with Minnesota Age Project.
All right.
And they'd like to say a few words, and then we'll get moving.
Thank you, Representative Frankie. And we understand that the goodies that are being passed around right now are from you this morning?
Yes, donuts. First time here.
Very good. Thank you very much for that. Ms. Elmer, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Annie Elmer, and I've been living with HIV for 26 years. When I found out I was positive, I asked the doctor how long I had to live, and I said that I'd probably be healthy for 3 years. There are a few things that have helped me stay alive this long. The life-saving drugs, which were introduced in 1996, have kept me and many others alive. I learned to manage the stress in my life and always work on having a reason to live. My current reason to live is to help educate people about HIV so that they won't get infected. My friend Dwayne and I share our stories with students at a few local schools. The emotional challenges of living with HIV have been the most difficult for me. I ask the teens to consider the emotional consequences of living with HIV and ask them what it would be like to get a yes answer to an HIV test. Here's one of the many thank you cards I get from students. Your story taught me a lot, especially when you were telling about your partner that gave you HIV. It really made me think, like, I can't trust everything everyone says. So after you guys came here, I went home, and my boyfriend came over, and I asked him, how many girls have you actually been with? And he told me only two, so I asked if he would come and get tested with me. He said he would, so I just want to say thank you, and you taught me a lot. So that's what works for me to stay healthy and alive. But many people don't get the support and health care that they need. And every new HIV infection costs Minnesota roughly $400,000 in lifetime medical costs. Please support the bill for a comprehensive plan to end HIV/AIDS in Minnesota so that we can implement all of the steps necessary so no one else has to experience this disease. And the state can save lots of money by keeping people healthy. Thank you for helping me help others prevent HIV.
Thank you, Ms. Elmer, for your testimony this morning and for the work you're doing and for your advocacy and for sharing your story with us this morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
At this point, we'll just take questions, Mr. Chair, in the interest of time.
That sounds good, Representative Frankie. Are there questions for Representative Frankie or the testifier? Seeing none, is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 2047? Seeing none, any final questions for Representative Frankie? Final word, Representative Frankie.
I just want to thank you, Mr. Chair, and the committee for hearing us today. I think this is something that we can get done, get accomplished, and help us to better place our resources to end this. So, thanks again. I hope
all right.
This bill.
With that, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 2047, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 2047, is, as amended, is re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Thank you, Representative Frankie.
Mr. Chair.
Representative McDonald.
I have a cold, so my ears are plugged. Did we thank Representative Frankie for the treats?
You just did, Representative McDonald.
All right.
All right. Next, we will take up House File 1091. And I will move that House File 1091 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Representative Hansen, welcome to the committee. I'm sure you found the morning to be enthralling here with one of your first times in front of the study.
Mr. Chair, it's better than drainage loft.
Everyone can save their puns for themselves. Now, I understand you have an amendment to get the bill into the form that you would like it.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I want to apologize, and this is completely my fault. The A1 amendment, which I'm going to pass out, is the reviser's technical correction. The A2 that you have in your packet, I am not going to move. So.
Okay. We'll now be off in A2, and Representative Liebling will move the A1. We will wait for a moment for the pages to get the amendment passed out. While we are doing that, Representative Hansen, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, you may remember this year during the Sunday sales discussion, Representative Loon and I had an interchange about capturing the revenue from the increased taxes that would come in from Sunday sales and dedicating that to chemical dependency programs. I've had that amendment a number of times, Mr. Chair. I have never been in front of this committee, so it's a new experience for me, and I hope you'll take that into account. Well, Frankie always gets the treats in front of me. He's always in front of me for some reason with bills, and he always
brings around again.
He could wrap around. So, Mr. Chair, as Representative McDonald is moving those around, I just think that, and I looked at the chemical dependency programs, and we appropriate money to those. I think this would be a good step there to try to get a little more money into these programs. I know there's someone from the department here who could talk about the costs of alcohol. There may be people in the audience who came. I know there was an effort to try to get some folks who may want to testify. I'm not sure if they're here. But I think the bill is somewhat self-explanatory. The estimates have varied in terms of the additional revenue that could come in. I have a fiscal note from 2011 that said $400,000. I have another estimate of like $10 million. And then I think there's another five, and we've had a variety of that. So the amendment, the A1 amendment, actually corrects, because the bill is written to when Sunday sales are approved. And as we know, they have been. So you could move the A1 amendment.
All right. Representative Liebling moves the A1 amendment. Are there any questions for the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Is there anyone who wishes to testify on House File 1091? All right, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Dana Farley. I'm an alcohol drug policy specialist for the Injury and Violence Prevention Section in the Minnesota Department of Health. I'm just here to testify real briefly about the need to provide funds for prevention activities within the A1 amendment. As you know, Minnesota has one of the highest binge drinking rates in the nation. Currently, it's ranked 6th in the nation. Recently, the CDC looked at data for the 500 largest cities in the nation for binge drinking. Minnesota has 4 cities that are in the top 20 in the nation for binge drinking. And binge drinking is not just tastes great and less filling, but often results in harms and injuries. The Minnesota Department of Health has data that shows that hospital-treated injuries have risen 275% from 2000 to 2014. And we're looking at these funds that would be looking at community health boards to continue some of the efforts that they're using with limited funds. Community health boards work at community engagement to look at policies around community festivals, beverage server training, compliance training, working at their local communities to try to reduce the harms of binge drinking. In the interest of time, I won't go into more data, but that's part of the approach that we're looking at. And I would stand for any questions.
Questions for Mr. Farley, Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that Representative Hoppe has a bill to reduce the drinking age to 19 to curtail the binge drinking. Do your studies indicate that binge drinking happens on Sundays?
Binge drinking happens every day. Mr. Chair, Mr. Hoppe, binge drinking happens at every day, and when we increase access and availability to alcohol, you have increased in binge drinking. The CDC has done many studies to show maintaining or when you change the access, whether it's by age or by hours or by days, that you will have increased in alcohol use and binge drinking.
Representative McDonald. Any other questions? Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Not so much a question, just a comment. I think that the idea of dedicating more funding to treatment programs is a great one. We know we're way underfunded. Thank you to the testifier. We know we have a huge problem in the state, and we always are underfunded, and this committee struggled a lot with what to do to fix the our whole mental health system, including chemical dependency issues. And you know, during the Sunday sales debate, there were always kind of competing claims that we're going to increase sales, or we're going to, a lot of the liquor store owners were saying, we're going to have to spread out our costs, but we're not going to make any more money. So I don't know which it is, and I'm not really sure how well this is going to be able to figure out what the actual additional revenue is, but that's not really the issue in this committee. I'm sure that will be talked about in the tax committee and so on. But I just want to commend Representative Hansen for continuing to think about this, because, indeed, we do have a really serious problem, and that is the concern of this committee. And anything that has the possibility of increasing the funds available for treatment is, I think, a pretty good idea. Thank you.
Mr. Burley.
I'd just like to make one comment, is that we're looking for funds to look at also just prevention. Many of the harms related to binge drinking don't necessarily result in dependency, but quite often it's injury, acute injury, overdose. Minnesota ranks, I think, 6th or 7th in alcohol overdose in the nation. So although treatment for addiction and alcoholism is very, very important and needed, just reiterating the case for prevention for those acute causes.
Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Representative Hansen here, I see that's coming out of the general fund, and you know what happens when we have taxes going into the general fund that aren't dedicated, that sometimes the legislature will decide to use those funds for other purposes. So I'm just wondering, how will you make sure that the necessary taxes collected will go to the programs that you deem necessary?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think, Representative Franson, if you look on 1091, it says the commissioner shall annually estimate the amount of the revenue so you can see what's coming in. So that transparency of that report should be there of what's coming in from the additional. And then I know Representative Loon and I have talked about trying to make sure we're really clear on that so folks can see that. And then that amount becomes the appropriated amount.
Okay.
Representative Franson.
And then would this be a grant program type of deal? Or how would you distribute the funds?
Representative Franson.
Or what do you envision?
So, Mr. Chair, I did look up and have studied the DHS chemical dependency programs. There's actually, in the governor's budget, there's the state-operated services, the Community Addiction Recovery Enterprise program at Brainerd. There's a special populations chemical dependency rate correction program, so it would be distributed for those programs proportionally.
Representative Franson.
All right, thank you.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify in House File 1091? Any final questions for the bill author? Final word, Representative Hansen.
I'd really like it if you passed this.
With that, I'll renew my motion, House File 1091, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails on House File 1091, as amended, as we refer to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. The members, we're going to try and get through one more bill yet this morning in the next 5 to 10 minutes. House File 1553, Representative Quam. As he makes his way forward, Representative Quam moves that House File 1553 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. Representative Quam, we have the bill in front of us. To your bill.
Thank you, members and Mr. Chair. And this bill is one in a long line to try and improve and fix issues with United Emergency Transport. And
maybe a very short statement from the gentleman next to me, and then we can go on for questions.
All right, and I understand there is a DE-2-1 amendment for Representative Quam.
Thank you. It basically takes out some of the taxicab language in the original bill. We're trying to move forward with consensus and agreement, or at least avoid people opposing this, and I think we've made great progress in doing that.
All right, are there any questions to the DE-2-1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the DE-2-1, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Mr. McAlpin, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and present your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members, Buck McAlpin, Minnesota Ambulance Association, representing R80, the Rural Transportation Non-Emergency Providers. As Representative Quam alluded to, Monday, the Non-Emergency Medical Transportation Committee met, which Sue Apler Holden's the chair of. And we always vet all these legislative proposals through that committee. And after dialogue with that committee, some things that they were either neutral on, a couple of them funding things. And there's really four provisions in this. One is some managed care language that was recommended by DHS that was in the governor's budget that folks agreed to. And the RUCA program, Rural Urban Commuter Adjustment, is something we did in 2009 to try to keep the infrastructure of rural Minnesota afloat with our non-emergency transportation providers. And it allows the SPIF and some of their payments, like we see in rural ambulances. We get a federal Medicare increase if you're located in one of these rural urban commuter spots. This is capped at up to 50 miles they pay RUCA, but our rural providers, as we've noticed some decline in some of the services, they're driving farther and farther, and this will be a fiscal issue. We'll have to work out with finance, but not sure what the cost is that to increase RUCA above 50 miles for rural providers. And then the proration language, everybody agreed to that. It's a very small amount of rides that we actually prorate in the state, and it's kind of cumbersome to do. And this language would repeal the proration requirement. And the rest of it mostly is just taking away and making some changes to some language that when the new modes went into effect 3 years ago, that it kind of cleans some of that up in here in a couple spots.
Thank you, Mr. McAlpin. Are there questions for Mr. McAlpin? Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And Mr. McAlpin, I'm just looking at the language of the bill on 5.25. Could you just explain what that's doing? I think it might be what you were just referring to, but...
Mr. McAlpin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, that's the proration.
Representative Liebling.
For all the modes of transportation.
Okay. I understood the words you said, but I don't understand the concept you're trying to convey.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair and Representative. The issue is if they pick up multiple patients, and we didn't want providers to help patients individually, and proration is tough to manage when there's multiple payers. 85%+ of these patients are in managed care. Some folks were adhering to it, some weren't adhering to it. And this would just take away the requirement that whether you're in fee-for-service or managed care that you did the proration.
Representative Liebling.
Okay. It's about as clear as, like, dirty water, maybe going back to Representative Hansen's comment. Okay. Just one other comment I wanted to make is just, actually a question for Representative Quam. Representative Quam, as you know, this is an area that former Representative Norton waded into a lot, and I just want to know if you're taking over for her in that very tough spot that she occupied for a number of years, because I know this is a very thorny issue that she struggled with for a long time. Are we now going to go to you on issues of non-emergency transportation?
The new coach bearer, Representative Quam.
Wherever I'm needed, I will try and fit in.
And I can guarantee that he means every word of that. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe this is in response to Representative Liebling's comments as well, but both myself and Representative Olson sit on the NEMT committee. And while history has certainly exhibited some tendencies towards this commission to be prone to vibrant conversation, I can assure you that the proverbial peace in the valley has been achieved with this amendment and with this language. All the stakeholders are in agreement, and I'm very pleased with the outcome of the amendment and the work that has been brought forth by Representative Quam.
Any other questions for the bill author? Final word, Representative Quam.
It's good. Vote for it.
With that, Representative Quam reduces his motion that House File 1553 as amended be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails and House File 1553 as amended is referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. With that, members, we will stand in recess until the call of the chair, approximately 3 o'clock. I know that's a little disappointing, but about 3 o'clock, and we will be in room 2. The committee will come back to order.
Thank you, Joe, for coming.
You're welcome.
First up this afternoon, as promised in our morning hearing, is 1362, and I will move that House File 1362 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Representative Scott, welcome to the committee. We have the bill in front of us.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and it's a pleasure to be here. And I do have an A-17 amendment.
All right, and I will move the A-17-0178 amendment. Representative Scott, to your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We made just a few word changes. Where before we had the word father in there, we've changed that to parents. We had explicitly said that the grant was for North Point Health and Wellness Center, who is here with me today, and found out that you can't articulate that in statute. You just have to give a more general description of the organization. So with that, I'll open with these words. Large numbers of children are born to unmarried parents, over 40% nationally and over 30% in the state of Minnesota. This is a concern for public policy because the children of unmarried parents are at risk, increased risk for a wide range of negative psychological, social, educational, and economic outcomes. For example, the children of unmarried parents are more than 3 times as likely to drop out of high school. Daughters of unmarried parents are more than 3 times as likely to have teenage pregnancy than the children of married parents. Moreover, the number of unmarried parents are much higher for parents at lower educational and income levels, which means the children of unmarried parents often face the burdens of poverty as well as the risk factors of unmarried parents. Fortunately, research shows that these risks can be reduced if the parents work together in a co-parenting relationship and if the non-custodial parent, usually the father, has a quality relationship with the child. From 2010 to 2013, Hennepin County was the site of a federally funded pilot project called Co-Parent Court. This program collected data to assess the impact of providing co-parenting support services to low-income parents who were establishing paternity. The services including co-parenting workshops, social services referrals, and assistance in developing a parenting plan, which is one of the great outcomes of the co-parenting course that you're going to hear about today. And by setting that forth in the co-parenting courts or co-parenting classes, it saves the courts time and resources. These things were provided at North Point Health and Wellness Center in North Minneapolis. The University of Minnesota conducted a rigorous evaluation of the program, and one of the evaluators put together a report right here talking about the effectiveness of this program. Unfortunately, the federal grant has ended and North Point is in need of financial support to continue this program and to help them provide assistance to replicate this important work hopefully in other counties, as they can help other counties. This bill would provide $200,000 per year for the next 2 years to continue this program. Co-parenting program staff from North Point are here to tell you about the work they are doing and how successful the program has been.
All right, and before we go to your testimony, are there any questions to the A-17-0178 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A-17 amendment, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Sarah Lieben. I work at North Point Health and Wellness Center, and I'm the Client and Family Services Director. North Point Health and Wellness Center is an integrated human services organization that is governed by a community board of directors that operates federally qualified health center in partnership with Hennepin County and a nonprofit organization that provides social services. Through our integrated model of care and services, clients and patients have access to medical, dental, behavioral health, laboratory, radiology, food support, and nutrition. Our approach is culturally responsive and trauma-informed care focused on the whole person, community well-being, and health equity. The program that is before you today for your consideration, Co-Parent Court, first operated in 2010. It was in partnership between Hennepin County Family Court, the University of Minnesota, and community organizations. The goal was to create a model for paternity establishment that supported co-parenting to improve the social, emotional, financial outcomes for children, families, and communities. The Co-Parent Court program meets the unique needs of unmarried parents through a combination of parenting workshops and individual advocacy and support. The facilitated workshops are based on a four-week evidence-based curriculum designed to focus on positive parenting and relationship building. The co-parent navigators work individually with parents to address the barriers that prevent them from being effective parents, such as housing, employment, and health care. Finally, parents are assisted in completing a parenting plan that guides them through joint decision-making about how they want to raise children together. When the University of Minnesota evaluated the program, the impact of co-parent against the control group, and they reported the following findings. Fathers that completed the co-parent program owed less child support than those that did not complete. Fathers saw an increase of amount of time that they spent with their children compared to the control group. 69% of fathers reported positive perception of the role of fathers compared to 31% of the control group. Themes from the interviews with parents included parents speaking with empathy and compassion and respect for their co-parents, mothers wanting more support for fathers in order to assist them with being good fathers, which we think is a key part of our program that we support not just the mother but also the father. Involvement is more than just financial or physical time spent, but it is an emotional present in the child's life. This is a model that we know works, and the impact for children, families, parents, and the community is significant. With this support, we can continue to document the model and evaluate the long-term financial and social impact so that it can be replicated in other communities.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Levin, for your testimony this afternoon. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Oh, my name is Rose McCullough, and I am a some of everything for Co-Parent Court. But I've been working with Co-Parent Court since 2010 from the beginning. So I saw how the program has changed many lives since 2010. I am a navigator, initially a case manager, but now I'm a navigator, and I actually teach the workshops that we were talking about in this program. The success rate has been overwhelming. It's been really good program. I've had a lot of parents or fathers who have come through, and they have been accepted back in their children's lives. They have been able to communicate more with their mothers, and it's just been a really positive thing.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Scott.
Thank you. I just wanted to add that I did go participate, or I guess I participated. I wasn't just observing. I participated in one of the co-parenting classes last week because I wanted to see just what they were doing. It's a very impressive program, and I was just so thrilled that there's a program like this out there that helps answer their questions in a very non-threatening way. I sat in with the mothers. They have separate classes for the mothers and the fathers, and really just teaching them to communicate with one another with respect, to recognize each other's differences in parenting styles, and to do whatever they can that's going to make their lives, the life of their children, better. So it was a very impressive night.
Questions for the testifiers. Representative Lohmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Scott. This sounds like an awesome bill and idea. I guess my question is, how do folks find out about you? How do you get people to come to your program?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lohmer, mm-hmm. Parents, initially we started with court referrals through Hennepin County. Family Justice Center, and what we found was that we weren't able to serve the community at large. So last July and July 2016, we actually opened it up to community referrals. So what we do now is we go throughout the community and talk about the program that we have to offer. We've talked about it to child support workers. We've talked about it to child protection workers. We've had conversations at correctional facilities for individuals that are being released into the community. We talked to MFIP counselors that are serving, you know, a lot of single moms, and we're really, our goal is to touch as many people as possible because we know that it's the cross-section of all those areas that need support.
Representative Womer. Thank you. Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, Chair Scott, great bill. I was curious, the testifiers spoke more so on the results for fathers. More from the university study. I know that there's also some moms that are having a tough time, too, kind of stepping up. I've got some constituents back in my area that have really wanted me to make sure that Dave, it's also the mother, too, can have just as much. It sounds like you're trying to hit both, but it sounds like, obviously, the problem is a little bit more on dads coming along, and maybe that's the case. But I just want to make sure the program is equally looked at from both the mom and the dad.
And actually, it is. The program is designed for both parents. We actually have mothers who seek custody as well or seek parenting time, and so they both get the same services offered to them either way, whether it's the father or the mother. So it definitely focuses on the mother as well.
Thank you.
Representative Baker, okay. Are there any other questions for Ms. Levin or Ms. McMulloff? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony today. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 1362? Seeing none, any final questions for the bill author? Representative McDonald.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And not a question, I'll make it very brief. I just want to compliment Representative Scott on this wonderful bill. I do have another bill that would help reunite fathers and their children. We see so many great things that coming of this economically and, of course, more important physically and spiritually. But it's just a wonderful, important program. I'm working with the Easter Seals that they do have a co-parenting program. But just think of the opportunity to get fathers back in their lives with their children and mothers, obviously, but it's usually moms. Yeah. Or moms, yes, but predominantly the fathers. But what a beautiful program. And happy to watch this progress. Actually, Representative Scott, I've been keeping an eye on this for since I found out you had this bill. So keep up the good work, and we look forward to having this in the bill, hopefully.
Any other questions for the bill author? Final word, Representative Scott.
I would just appreciate your support.
With that, I'll renew my motion that House File 1362 as amended be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails on House File 1362 as amended is re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Thank you, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Next up, we will take House File 559, Representative Franzen. As she makes her way forward, Representative Franzen moves that House File 559 be re-referred to the General Register. We have the bill in front of us, Representative Franzen, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members here. I've got some wonderful people from the city that's easy to get to and hard to leave, Alexandria. I just want to say good afternoon, and thank you for allowing us to testify on House File 559, which is proposed legislation to allow public hospitals to adopt a written investment policy, policies that provide more flexibility to invest hospital revenue funds in securities in which have been recommended by investment advisors or by a bank or trust company, notwithstanding any limitations in Chapter 118A. With me today is Carl Bogness, the CEO, and Nate Meyer, the CFO of Douglas County Hospital in Alexandria, Douglas County. The hospital is the second largest public hospital in the state, and they are taking the leadership role in pursuing this later on this legislation because the current policies restrict or have put restrictions on our public hospitals at a disadvantaged rate compared to nonprofit 501c3 hospitals. This legislation is a bold step in an effort to allow governmental health care facilities to level the playing field with their peer nonprofit 501c3 facilities that are not bound by the same stringent investment restrictions. I want to stress that this bill is drafted with precautions and is voluntary and is nothing that a public hospital has to do. According to the Minnesota Hospital Association, 26 hospitals remain publicly owned as either city, county, or district, and the Minnesota Hospital Association Policy and Advocacy Committee has reviewed and supports this legislation. I want to acknowledge and also thank some of my fellow colleagues in the House who have co-signed in support of this bill to help our public hospitals, Representative Albright, Representative Schumacher, Representative Swedinski, Representative Clark Johnson, Representative Nornes, and Representative Eklund. And at this time, Mr. Chair and members, I'd like to invite Carl Vaknes and Nate Meyer of Douglas County Hospital to testify regarding House File 559.
Mr. Vaknes, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today to testify on this on our behalf of the public hospitals. We are, as Representative Franzen mentioned, one of 26 public hospitals in the state out of 143 hospitals. Last year, our hospital entertained a study to determine whether or not we should convert from a public governmental hospital to a 501c3 hospital, and in the process of that study, we determined that there was a significant difference in the investment restrictions on public hospitals compared to our 501c3 hospitals, and there are 119 501c3 hospitals in the state. We have take great pride in the fact that we are a public hospital, and our board was very reluctant to pursue conversion to a 501c3 hospital without first pursuing the opportunity to at least address an inequity that exists right now between public hospitals and 501c3 hospitals. So the amendment that we are proposing currently, the opinion of our county auditor and state auditors is that the hospital is subject to the restrictions, investment restrictions of 118A04. The proposed amendment would broaden the investment opportunities for public hospitals, and it would establish an oversight requirement with respect to that investment, the investment of those funds as a public hospital. You know, this is important for a lot of reasons, but you know, our facilities, our technologies are always aging. We are, in order to remain a modern, state-of-the-art facilities, it's important for us to have dollars to be able to reinvest in our facilities. Currently, we our average returns as a public hospital, because we're limited to government-backed securities, is less than 1%, or around 1%, compared to 501c3 hospitals, which is often 5 to 6% investment returns and so forth. Also, our ability to recruit and retain physicians depends upon having those modern state-of-the-art facilities as well. So having access to 24/7 facilities in our community to serve the people in our community is very important. I'd like to invite our CFO, Nate Meyer, as well to speak more specifically to the financial impact that this that not passing this bill would have on us, or passing this bill would have on us as an organization, unless there are questions.
All right, Mr. Meyer, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Nate Meyer. I work as the CFO at Douglas County Hospital. I think what I will start out with is that the hospitals, we keep in operations through two ways. One is through operations, hospital operations, and the other is through non-operating revenue. And that's what we're talking about here today, is the non-operating revenue, the part we're talking about there. We've been very successful as an organization through efficient operations to run very good margins through our hospital operations. We just want to have the ability to stay up with our peers on the non-operating side of it. I do get the question every once in a while, even from some of our managers, well, we're considered a nonprofit. Why do you need net income if you're a nonprofit? Well, there's three reasons mainly that you need a profit for our organization. The first one that we need one for is just for working capital. We always have to pay our bills, we have to pay our employees. That for some reason the cash flows start to slow down, we still need to pay our employees and those sort of things. We need working capital. The second one is for principal on our debt. We have about $40 million in debt on our balance sheet right now. It's like some of us have mortgages on our house. We've had to, as we've grown as an organization, we've had to borrow money for that. And so to pay down that the principal portion of that mortgage, that's the second reason that hospitals need net income as an organization. And then the third is just for property, plant, and equipment. Every year, over the course of the last 10 years, our organization has purchased about $80 million, has invested about $80 million into property acquisition, property expansion, building expansion, equipment for our organization. And so those are the three reasons that we need to have positive net income to continue to be a viable organization, hospital, in providing and delivering healthcare services in that aspect. So with that being said, over the course of the last 10 years that we did do that, we have, with the $80 million in investment that we have done as an organization, half of that, as I mentioned, we've raised through debt, $40 million, and the other $40 million has been through successful operations. So if we feel with this bill, with this passing of this bill, or passing of this amendment, we would be able to use more so from operations, from the non-operating part of our operations, instead of having to go out and borrow from banks and social, and then pay interest expense associated with that. So that's the financial side of why this is important for us as an organization.
All right, thank you, Mr. Meyer and Mr. Bachness, for your testimony this afternoon. Are there any questions for the testifiers? Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Franson, and to the testifiers. I enjoy spreadsheets and number. I'm just curious, so the non-operating side, are you prohibited from moving that over to the operating side, the cash balance there?
Mr. Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The non-operating, so right now hospitals operate, I'll put it in ratios of days cash at hand. And so under our balance sheet, the average in the industry is about 149 days cash on hand. What days cash on hand is defined as is how many days a hospital can operate without taking in any revenue in but paying all their expenses. Every day that our facility is open, we have about $350,000 in expenses on a daily basis. And so we've built up cash to the point where, and that's how the hospital business, that's how hospital operations are. We're a very capital intensive industry, but we don't have all those expenditures in 1 year. We don't build a new building every year. We have to replace buildings maybe every 10 years. And so we run our operations, and so we build up those cash balances until the 10 years from now, when we do have those big expenditures that we have, that's when we will use that cash. And so that's the cash that we're talking about that we want to invest into securities, which our peers are doing, instead of being restricted by government-backed securities.
Representative Kreisha.
Okay, thank you. And that makes sense. I understand that. So you're building up this cash on for capital investments. On the operating side, how much cash are you keeping there in reserves?
Mr. Meyer.
We set ratios for all the, we set about 25 days cash on hand is what we feel we can operate with. And so that's roughly about, well, whatever, 25 is 350,000 is, that's roughly somewhere in the 8.5 million is what we go off of. And so that goes for the flows I was talking about in working capital and to pay all our bills. And so yep, we get those flows that go up and down.
Representative Kreisha.
Okay, so and forgive me. So you carry about $8.5 million for a certain amount of days, operating days, and the cash on the other side, on the non-operating, you have to carry that out for future investments, not necessarily for operating expenses. I just want to make sure.
Yeah,
I
didn't, that's correct,
sense. Mr. Meyer.
Yep. Sorry, Mr. Chair. That is correct.
Okay, and so
Representative
then.
Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How much are you carrying roughly in bad debt or debt that hasn't been collected through delinquent patients?
This year we'll have about $2.5 million of bad debt that we will have as an expense in our income statement, or not as an expense, but as a breakdown to our revenue that we expect this year. And that's, and actually we're one of the more favorable hospitals in the state in that question.
Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. No further questions.
All right. Any other questions for the testifiers? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for staying with us throughout the day today and for making the trip down from Alexandria. And We hope we can get this done for you here in the next couple of weeks. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify in House File 559? Seeing none, any final questions for the bill author? Seeing none, final word, Representative Franson.
I think that Mr. Bachness and Mr. Meyer did a good job of explaining the bill, and I will leave it at that, and I appreciate your vote.
With that, Representative Franson renews her motion that House File 559 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 559 is referred to the General Register.
Thank you.
Yeah. Representative Gruenhagen, House File 1357 is up next. And as he's making his way down, Representative Gruenhagen moves that House File 1357 be re-referred to the Health and Human Service Finance Committee. We have the bill in front of us, Representative Gruenhagen, whenever you're ready.
I have an A1 amendment.
Representative Gruenhagen moves the A1 amendment. Representative Gruenhagen, to your amendment.
It's just a technical amendment, members, Mr. Chair.
Okay, any questions to the A1 amendment? All those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion, the amendment is adopted. Representative Gruenhagen, to your bill as amended.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. HF 1357 expands the health care services that are covered when performed by a chiropractor. The bill would cover therapy services and evaluation and management services if the services, one, are currently covered under medical assistance, two, are within the chiropractic scope of practice, three, are medically necessary, and four, they have been specified by the Commissioner of Human Services in consultation with the Human Services Advisory Committee. This does not mandate coverage. It just puts, the bill puts the chiropractic organization in a position to negotiate with the Commissioner of Human Services and Health Services Advisory Committee as far as any coverage is concerned. Today I have with me Dr. Chuck Sawyer, representing the Minnesota Chiropractic Association.
All right, Dr. Sawyer, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Chuck Sawyer, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Chiropractic Association, and I'm a licensed chiropractic doctor. First, I want to thank Representative Gruenhagen for bringing this legislation forward. It would cover, as he mentioned, certain therapy and evaluation and management services provided by chiropractic doctors, and with regard to the latter, for those of you that are not familiar with that term, history is an examination. So when the patient comes to see a physician, either medical or a chiropractic physician, of course, there's an examination that's done. Currently, in Minnesota law, we are reimbursed for only one exam annually, which creates a significant problem if that patient returns after a period of time. And an exam again is required, but we're not reimbursed for that. And the services to be included are currently covered under medical assistance when provided by other healthcare providers, MD physicians, physical therapists, physical medicine and rehabilitation specialists, and so forth. And they are within our scope of practice and obviously our training. Our intent is to have this apply to services that are typically covered by private health insurance but are not covered under medical assistance currently. Examples include such things as ultrasound therapy, various forms of electrical stimulation, and especially supervised in-office rehabilitation, which is especially indicated for patients suffering from chronic back and neck pain. Studies show that chiropractic treatment is an effective and low-cost alternative in the treatment of back pain, and that's especially noteworthy because back pain is now recognized in the United States as the leading cause of days lost due to disability. So it's a considerable burden, both in terms of being away from work and being away from the activities of daily living, and obviously the cost. And moreover, the effectiveness of a chiropractic manipulative treatment, which is kind of the bedrock of what we do, increases when done in conjunction with other therapies. So some of the things I just mentioned, when combined with manipulation, will often speed the recovery and are a great benefit to the patient. It's also worth noting that the American College of Physicians recently published a practice guideline that recommends the use of several non-pharmacologic treatment methods commonly employed by chiropractic doctors. And that practice guideline was developed, and the context does include the current challenge that we're all facing with regard to opioid medication addiction and the consequences. The specific services will be covered will be specified by the Commissioner of Human Services after review and recommendation by the Health Services Advisory Committee. That is what they do for all medical procedures. So I would encourage you to support House File 1357, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Sawyer, for your testimony this afternoon. Are there any questions for Dr. Sawyer? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony today. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 1357? Seeing none, are there any questions from members for the bill author, Representative Baker?
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen, for bringing this. I had a chance to talk to Dr. Sawyer earlier, and I think we've got to sort of get our minds ahead of chiropractic medicine is really good today. It is different than it was 15, 20 years ago. At least the reputation is much better. I think I'm not saying that the practice has changed a lot. I just know that my folks back in my district really do a lot of amazing things, and they don't go right to medicine first. So I appreciate that. I think it's sort of silly that we MA only allows folks to go there one time a year when that can save us so much money. So with that, I just thank Representative Greenhagen for bringing this forward, and this is a really good idea that will save us a lot of money. Thanks.
Any other questions for Representative Grunhagen? Seeing none, final word, Representative Grunhagen.
You know, I just have to agree with Representative Baker on that. My wife had a real bad car accident before we got married, and she would have had to have back surgery probably several times if it wasn't for good chiropractic coverage. So it's one of the reasons I decided to offer the bill to support it. Thank you, members, for hearing this and for your support.
With that, Representative Grunhagen renews his motion that House File 1357, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 1357, as amended, is referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Thank you, Dr. Sawyer, for coming today. Next up, Representative Grunhagen, House File 202. Representative Grunhagen moves that House File 202 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. We have the bill in front of us. Representative Grunhagen, to your bill.
Yeah, members, what House File 202 does, it removes the 10% requirement outside the seven-county metro area for dental providers on the treatment for medical assistance of Minnesota Care patients, dental patients. My sister works for a dentist, and she gets daily calls from medical assistance patients seeking dental care. Her dentist currently used to accept 4 to 5% of the patients of their patients for Medicaid. He couldn't accept any more with that because, as we heard in previous testimony from yesterday, the reimbursement rate is one of the lowest, if not the lowest, in the nation. And dental providers actually lose money on the treatment of these patients. The in Proud County, we have only one provider that is currently accepting medical assistance dental patient at this time. I've talked to her. By the way, it's a bipartisan bill. I have DFL supporters on the bill. Also in Sibley County, I don't think there's any additional or dentist taking any additional Medicaid patients at this time. As I said, my sister works for a dentist. When he did take 4 to 5% of his patients locally for medical assistance, somebody reported him because he wasn't taking 10%, so now he takes none. You know, I know it sounds like a good idea. Well, we'll get the medical assistance people in to see a dentist, but in reality, it seems like they're being blocked from seeing a dentist because many of them can't accept the 10% requirement. You know, it's kind of like Obamacare requirement. When Obamacare came out, it said that if you were an employer and you had more than 50 employees that worked 30 hours or more, you had to provide them health insurance. While there was an employer in my district that had over 50 employees, he moved all of them to 29 except for management, 29 hours a week. So they all lost the health insurance they had, which was a real great plan, but it no longer was a qualified plan. And the employer moved them to 29 hours, so they didn't get any health insurance. So now some of them have to work two or three jobs, where before they were getting enough hours to provide for themselves. So what government sees as a mandate and a requirement can actually backfire and create more problems than it solves. I would strongly urge you to support this, especially in the rural area. I believe it'll create better access and more people getting the treatment that they need. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Representative Grimhagen. You have no testifiers on this bill, is that correct?
Dominic was going to testify. He didn't know if he could make it this afternoon. He does support the bill. He was here this morning, but I don't see him in the audience.
Okay. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 202? Seeing none, member questions. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Grimhagen. We put Rule 101 in place. I wasn't here, but it was in place to make sure that providers, if they were going to participate in CGIP, which is a big pool of public employees, that they also take on the responsibility of people in medical assistance of Minnesota Care. And if we break that, right, which I think is essentially what we're talking about here, it seems to me that there might be decent access for people in CGIP, but that the shortage that we're already experiencing in Minnesota Care and medical assistance would be exacerbated. It seems like this would make that worse. Can you help me understand your argument a little bit more, please?
Representative Grimhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Murphy. Yeah, I did exclude the seven-county metro area where a lot of those public employees are. In some rural areas, again, some of the reps that signed on here, both from both sides of the aisle, they say that some of their medical assistance patients have to drive up to 100 miles to provide a provider. Again, my sister, I've talked to other dental providers in my little community and even in the neighboring county, and they all say the same thing. If you lift that 10% requirement, we will accept some patients. Currently, there's over 900 rural providers. Again, I did exclude the seven-county metro area. About 400 of them accept medical assistance patients. How many are actually accepting new patients? I'm not completely sure. I know it's a problem that is on the crisis level in many areas of rural Minnesota.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Grimhagen. I hear what you're saying, and I just want to be clear. The proposal is to say to dentists in greater Minnesota that you can continue to see Minnesotans who get their coverage through CGIP, but we will relieve you of the responsibility of 10% of your patient panel being in Minnesota Care or medical assistance. That's right. Correct?
Correct.
All right. So what I hear most from people in greater Minnesota is that if they're in using medical assistance or Minnesota Care, they can't get access to a dentist. And it seems like this proposal would take us away from that, that then more people in medical assistance and Minnesota Care would not have access. So unless I am, like, reading this wrong, can you, I guess I don't have a question. I'm saying out loud what I think is the conclusion of the bill, which is counter to what you're arguing.
Representative Grimhagen.
Oh, thank you, Ms. Chair. Thank you, Representative Murphy. No, you said it correctly. They can't, people in rural Minnesota can't get access. And one of the reasons I firmly believe they can't get access, based on the testimony of my dental providers, and my sister's worked in the dental office for probably over 20 years, is because of this 10% requirement. Again, similar to Obamacare, we said any employer that has over 50 employees that work over 30 hours have to have health insurance. So in my district, an employer with over 50 employees left health insurance in place for management but moved all his employees to 29 hours a week. That actually hurt them. So what was intended to actually help those employees wound up giving them, between the mandate of essential benefits by Obamacare and the 30-hour requirement, and then high cost of providing health insurance, they actually wound up with no health insurance at 29 hours a week. This is a similar situation. You had the 10% requirement for rural area. Dentists cannot afford to take 10%. They live in rural areas. Many of these dentists are very generous. The dentist my sister works for would take 3 to 4% of his patients, and he was taking that until somebody reported him, and then he had to give that up so he doesn't take any anymore. and yet she gets daily calls from medical assistants, dental patients who want access and can't get it. So what is intended to bring access through a government mandate actually is eliminating access in many cases.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Greenhagen. I appreciate the explanation, and I just think that I understand your argument now, that they would do less. They don't want to do a whole 10%, but they would do less. But the difference between 3 or 4% and 10% is still a gap. And so if it were 6% or 7% of the people, those people then would not have access. So we would be, in another way, reducing access for people in who get their coverage through Minnesota Care Medical Assistance.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I can just relate from my district and what in Dennis and White Bear Lake and the Northeast Metro, very few see Medicaid patients. There are some that do. But if in the dentist that I talked to this year said that he had to stop seeing Medicaid patients a while ago, sees a morning, a week of patients for free, rather than deal with all of the overhead and whatnot. But if patients do want to be referred to a Medicaid dentist, they can do so within White Bear, within Maplewood, within 15, 20 minutes drive from where we live. Whereas if you're in Rock County or Pennington County or someplace where stuff is far apart.
We want to ask what stuff.
It's a big difference, and that 10% threshold is a big deal. So that for many dentists it would mean that they could see some patients or that they could do less charity care. So I understand why with the travel distances. And then last year we looked at the reimbursement rates for rural versus metro and just made a conscious decision that the metro rates weren't going to be fair and as well just because of the crisis in greater Minnesota to do whatever we could. So I understand the need for that from a very practical level. Obviously, we're really getting hurt on the reimbursement rates relative to other places. We've got to fix that. But until we do, I think Representative Greenhagen's got a couple really good ideas. This one, I also like your volunteer bill where you could volunteer and get a break or something to try to incentivize rural Minnesota to get some better access, particularly in underserved areas.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And along the same lines, it's even in Duluth, a metropolitan area that I met with a group of folks in Duluth where they actually called. It was a group of folks on MA, and they actually went through and called every dentist in Duluth to try and see if they could get an appointment and showed me their results, and they couldn't get an appointment. And they actually have to go to Deer River, which is a long drive, and it's leaving Duluth. So this isn't, it's rural Minnesota, it's Duluth, it's a real problem. And so I appreciate that you are bringing forward bills that gets at this. But I do see some concerns that if that's already the case, that dentists are taking their 10% and we're having people having to drive to Deer River, that this may help dentists who are doing, you know, I've been told I've also met with dentists who are eating it because of the low reimbursement rate. So I think we need to address it at its root, which is the reimbursement cost, because I think this would even make it harder for those folks I met with in Duluth on MA if dentists drop down the rates that they're seeing. I don't even know what their recourse would be, or waiting for months and months or going to an emergency room or doing all of those things that are way more costly. So I wonder how you would respond to those folks in my district who I sat with that, how you could see them actually getting the care that they need with this bill.
Representative Greenhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Olson. Yeah, it's a crisis, and I think the 10% requirement is one of the reasons that dentists aren't taking medical assistance patients, and that's true in my community and also with my conversations with the area dentist. And, you know, they could take some, And it's not like they're going to, the ones that aren't taking any now could probably take 4 to 5%. And when I deal with professional people, by the way, I find them to be some of the most generous people out there. They want to help their patients. But when you put them in a situation where they have to take 10% and they can't afford to do it, they're going to take none. And, you know, like the dentist my sister works for, he was taking 4 to 5%. He was helping out some nursing home people and stuff. Well, he couldn't take any more than that. He just started his practice. He bought it from a retiring dentist. And he just couldn't, and to provide for his staff and the services he wanted to, he couldn't afford it anymore. So more than 4 to 5%. So somebody reported him, and now he takes none. Okay, so instead of taking 4 to 5%, which he tried to do and still keep his business solvent, now he's taking none. So in your situation, there should be dentists that maybe will take 2, 3, 4, 5% of their patients. They can't take 10%, and you should actually see better access. Again, think of government mandates. Most times the mandate backfires and you get worse results, not better. Under Obamacare, we're going to give people work 30 hours with 50 or more employees. We're going to make sure they have health insurance. What does the employer do who can't afford to do that? He moves his employees to 29 hours. Now they have no health insurance and they work less hours. So they have less income, so they got to get another part-time job. So what was intended to be good as a government mandate actually backfires. I believe that when you remove this 10%, you're going to see many more dentists take 4, 5, 6% and give those people the access and the treatment that they need for their dental problems.
Representative Olson.
Yeah, and I understand that, but I also, the dentist in Duluth, I do think, take a high percentage, probably the 10%. I think, you know, talking with dentists that do a lot of that. So if they're dropping down to 4 or 5%, or what happens to those folks that are currently being served if they're now given the option to drop down?
Representative Gerhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the question, Representative Olson. According to the information I received from MMV, there's over 900 and some dental providers in rural Minnesota, and only about 400 that accept medical assistance patients. So if the majority of those additional 900 accept patients, it should more than offset if any dentist decides to take less than 10%.
Representative Olson.
And I would just be curious if that was true for my area specifically, because right now I think the crisis is more around the reimbursement rate than the fact that the dentists are feeling the pinch between whether they take 3% or 10%. And that's, I guess, more of a comment, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Olson. Are there any other questions, Representative Baker?
No.
Are there any other questions for the bill author? Oh, Representative Keel.
Sorry. Yes, I am here. Maybe this is not more of a, well, it's a thought. If we did less requirement, did the 4 or 5%, would some of those people that are more than likely traveling to Duluth or in my neck of the woods, Moorhead, and going to 2 hours, would they be able to see a dentist closer that could actually do the 4%? Because I hear all the same conversations. Many of them don't do that anymore. People are having to drive 2, 3 hours to see a dentist. So my question is, would more dentists closer to home provide those services so that the dentist that is serving more people would do less because those people wouldn't drive that far? Does that make sense?
Representative Gerhagen.
Yes. No, Mr. Chair, I do.
Representative Baker.
Okay. I'll be short. I hear what Representative Olson is saying, and Representative Miller or Murphy. As a restaurant operator, I can sort of really relate to this, that if I take customers and I'm forced to take 10% of them and all of my customers in the restaurant, and I will give them an 80% discount on their bill. But if I do that, I have to take certain other customers, and I'll make obviously better money, but I'm still better off taking none of those because I'm losing too much. Now, I give away a lot of food and a lot of donations every year. But what is it? It's not mandated. And I think what you're getting to is operators, dentists, doctors, restaurant folks, whatever, if we don't have sort of these handcuffs on us, I really think, part of it is hope, I really think you will see generosity flourish. I think this bill is ready for this time now, and I think it's time to let this thing go, and I appreciate the comment on that. I just, because I can relate this to my own restaurant, so thank you.
Final word, Representative Grunhagen.
You know, I would, well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for hearing the bill. I would really like to increase that reimbursement rate, too. We heard about that last meeting, I think, last committee meeting. I think the price tag was $300 million that was mentioned. And, you know, members, with the changes at the federal level with Obamacare, the possible loss of up to $1.3 billion in medical assistance funding in the future here, I don't know to what degree we're going to be able to increase that reimbursement rate to where it should be. I do know that government mandates usually backfire, and I trust in the generosity and free market principle of giving professionals the opportunity to help people in need. I've seen that happen time and time again. I believe they will respond, if given a chance, in a way that they can afford, but not necessarily at the 10% level. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
With that, Representative Grunhagen renews his motion, and House File 202 is re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign.
No.
The motion prevails, and House File 202 is re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. And it looks like we're going to close the day out with Representative Zerwas.
I love his bills.
The first bill up is House File 1705. Representative Dean moves that House File 1705 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. We have the bill in front of us. Representative Zerwas, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chino. Thank you, members. House File 1705 is a bill brought to us by NAMES, the Association of Medical Equipment Sellers. The bill aims to continue the work that we've done over the last several sessions, trying to decouple or de-link the Medicaid and Medicare reimbursement schedules. This legislation is actually in response to federal legislation that was just passed around the CARES Act, and the response that the state would need to put into place legislatively in order to not see a drastic cut in reimbursement at the state level to our medical equipment, durable medical equipment providers, which if those cuts were to go into effect, would have a huge impact on access and being able to take care of folks in Minnesota. Mr. Chair, members, I do have two testifiers with me today that can provide more detail on the response that the state of Minnesota needs to do to comply with the CARES Act and still keep our reimbursement level at the point necessary in order to make the equipment accessible to our population.
All right. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Hello, my name is Cami Ozender. I'm the Chief Operating Officer and General Counsel with Pediatric Home Service, and I serve as the Chair of the Legislative Committee for the Midwest Association of Medical Equipment Services. As Representative Zerwas describes, we're here today to ask for your support on House File 1705, which maintains the rates for durable medical equipment and supplies under the Medical Assistance Program. The legislature has long supported the value of durable medical equipment and supplies as an integral part of our healthcare system. We have further recognized that there are differences in the needs of our medical assistance population, which comprises medically complex infants and adults with disabilities, and that their needs are simply different than the Medicare population. To that end, last session, after several years of temporary solutions, with your support, we were able to set a rate methodology under medical assistance that was distinct from Medicare, that was predictable to providers, which could be implemented by our state's computer system, and most importantly, that was appropriate for the needs of our medical assistance population. We're here today asking you to continue that commitment in the face of decreasing federal funds that are set to take effect in January 1st of 2018 under the CARES Act, as Representative Zerwas describes, and as my colleague will further explain. We have continued to work with the department to come up with language that will meet our shared goals, which also include maximizing the federal funding that is available. And with that, I'll turn it over to my colleague, Sarah Anderson.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Anderson. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Sarah Anderson. I'm the Vice President of Sales and Third-Party Services for Key Medical Supply, and I'm a member of the Board of Directors for the Minnesota Midwest Association of Medical Equipment Services. As Representative Zerwas and my colleague Ms. Zender have described, the Federal CARES Act creates a problem for Minnesota in maintaining the unique rates that we have established through our work together in the past few sessions, and that necessitates this bill in order to maintain the level of access and the level of quality that we have set forward as our value in Minnesota's Medicaid program. As we talked about, the populations served are very different. The program behind the CARES Act is designed for seniors who are homebound. The quality of product and the life expectancy of the product is designed to meet seniors' needs in their homes. The population served by medical assistance, as my colleague has stated, is a younger, more chronically complex, with a higher level of disability than the Medicare population. And they are integrated into our community, which is what we want, is to maintain that integration. So the bill that we have before you is to allow for the state to continue the level of access, to continue the level of quality that we have established, and to do so while maximizing that federal match.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Zender and Ms. Anderson, for your testimony this afternoon. Are there any questions for the testifiers? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony today. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 1705? Seeing none, questions for the bill author? Final word, Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And as Ms. Zender mentioned earlier, I would be remiss if I didn't thank the department. We've been working on this for several years now, and they've been very helpful as we're trying to find language that will work to keep our rates exactly flat and the same today and January 1st, 2018, as they are today, and trying to work with and around the federal guidelines that were passed. So they've been very helpful, and we continue that work.
With that, Representative Dean renews his motion that House File 1705 is referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails and House File 1705 is referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Next, we have House File 1819. And I will move that House File 1819 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Representative Zerwas, welcome back to the committee. We have the bill in front of us. To your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1819 is legislation that will bring the state of Minnesota into compliance with the covered outpatient drugs final rule, which was released last January of 2016 by the Center for Medicaid and Medicaid Services, and that's changes to pharmacy reimbursements. Minnesota must submit our state plan to CMS by the required June 30th deadline. I have Brian Carr from the Minnesota Retailers to talk about the process and the policy bill in more detail.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Carr. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Brian Carr. I'm the Government Relations Director and Legal Counsel at the Minnesota Retailers Association. We're a statewide trade association that represents small, Main Street, regional, and national retailers across the state. And with specificity to this legislation today, I'm here representing our retail chain pharmacies and our independent pharmacy members, which include single-store pharmacies located in Greater Minnesota, to voice our support for Representative Zerwas's House File 1819. Collectively, Minnesota chain and independent pharmacies employ approximately 71,000 full and part-time workers, including 3,260 pharmacists, paying about $960 million in state taxes. Mr. Mr. Chair and members, in January of 2016, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services issued the covered outpatient drugs final rule, implementing significant changes to pharmacy reimbursement for both brand and generic drugs dispensed to our Medicaid population. Although I defer to DHS for the exceedingly complex details compromising the CMS final rule, I will share with you two very broad strokes of what the CMS final rule means for our retail pharmacies operating in Minnesota and why House File 1819 is required in a timely fashion. First, the CMS final rule requires pharmacy reimbursement for drug products to be changed from an estimated acquisition cost methodology to an actual acquisition cost methodology. As implied by the name, pharmacies will make no profit on products. This will result in reduced reimbursement for retail pharmacies. That said, the CMS final rule also requires states to reimburse pharmacies for their cost to dispense drug products. This is known as a professional dispensing fee. Just as with the actual cost of product, the professional dispensing fee is now required to be cost-based. DHS used survey data to propose a new professional dispensing fee that complies with the CMS final rule. This proposed professional dispensing fee will result in an increase for reimbursement for all retail pharmacies. There are budget ramifications for these reimbursement changes, but I understand we'll talk about that in a different committee, Mr. Chair. However, before we can address those budgetary impacts, we need to update our statute to reflect the new requirements for an actual acquisition cost methodology and a professional dispensing fee. Our current statutory language will be out of compliance as of April 1st of this year. Updating our statutes will also enable DHS to meet the CMS deadlines for submitting its required state plan amendment to CMS by the deadline of June 30th, as Representative Zerwas mentioned. Fortunately, much of the hard work to comply with CMS rule is already done. We've worked, and we thank DHS for engaging pharmacy stakeholders in a very transparent fashion. DHS implemented an inclusive process of explaining the final rule to stakeholders, starting with a request for information in July of 2016. DHS then received feedback through three webinars, helped draft legislative language, a fiscal analysis, and a pathway to submitting the required state plan amendment. In short, members, House File 1819 is a necessary step in a larger process for complying with the CMS final rule. Thank you for listening to my testimony today.
Thank you, Mr. Carr. Are there questions for Mr. Carr? Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Brian, testify, Brian, thank you so much. We've had a good conversation about this, and I've had a chance to think about this a little bit, too. One thing I'm trying to get my head wrapped around, and I know the finance stuff is coming, but this is the only time I get to speak to this, is that overall the costs are going to go up for drugs. And I need to understand, because I'm one of the members maybe that might be frustrated with the PBMs and the cut that they're going to make on this. Can you help me understand if anything will change with the pharmaceutical benefit managers out there that will participate in this and how that's going to affect them as well in this, if you can comment to that, please?
Mr. Carr.
Mr. Chair, Representative Baker, thank you for the question. I do not represent pharmacy benefit managers, and it would be inappropriate for me to comment on how this will impact them.
Representative Baker.
Okay, I appreciate that. Do you know, or does anybody know, how the money flows on these kind of transactions, and who actually maybe has a stop on that to see if somebody does have an answer on that? I'm just curious. If you don't know it, that's fine. I'm just looking for facts, because this is a lot of state and federal dollars that are going to start going up, but I just want to know who's going to get a piece of this.
Mr. Kerr.
Mr. Chair, Representative Baker, thank you again for the question. I do not know. I'm happy to help track that down for you. I just want to be clear for the record that the cost-based reimbursement for drugs is actually going to go down under this methodology. What's going to increase is the professional dispensing fee under this methodology.
Representative Baker.
Just a statement. I understand that. I just know that anytime something changes, there might be another slice of the pie somewhere else. So I'd like to maybe look at that another day. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Baker. Are there any other questions for Mr. Carr? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony, Mr. Carr. Mr. Lindu, if you could make your way down, please. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Lindu. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jeff Lindu with the Minnesota Pharmacists Association to speak to Representative Baker's question. This will have no impact on the pharmacy benefit manager industry. This only impacts bills that are claims that are billed directly to the state of Minnesota through Minnesota's claim processing system. So there is no, actually the state of Minnesota and is the claims, is the PBM in this situation. And so they, as the PBM, essentially they are setting the new rates at which they will reimburse. So there isn't any slice for private industry in this.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Lindu, for your testimony. Are there any questions for Mr. Lindu? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony today. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify in House File 1819? Seeing none, are there any final questions for Representative Zerwas on House File 1819? Seeing none, final word, Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1819, when we get to HHS finance and talk about the fiscal implications, this will be a challenging bill, but I know it's part of trying to come into federal compliance.
With that, I will renew my motion that House File 1819 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 1819 is referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Carr and Mr. Lindu. All right, finally today, Representative Zerwas and House File 1739. I will move that House File 1739 be re-referred to the Health and Human Service Finance Committee. We have the bill in front of us, Representative Zerwas, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1739 deals with competitive bidding. In 2011, the legislature made a number of changes to how we procure managed care contracts for PMAP and Minnesota Care. We moved to a system of competitive bidding. These contracts as a way to try to bring additional savings to the state. The Department of Human Services has gone through three major procurement cycles. The first one was for the metro area. The second one included 27 rural counties. And the most recent procurement cycle in 2015 was the first time in DHS procedure where they contracted statewide. After going through these cycles, I think it's important to take a look at how the procurement process is working, in some cases, quite frankly, not working, and make some adjustments to the procedures for how we really put some guardrails on the process moving forward. I have Joel Euland here from UCARE, who can give a little bit more background on the procurement process, certainly how UCARE was impacted throughout that process, and we can walk through the bill.
All right, and Representative Zerwas, you have the DE1 amendment, is that correct?
Correct, we need to move the DE1.
All right, I will move the DE1 amendment. Are there any questions to the DE1 amendment to get the bill into the form that the author wishes to present it? Seeing none, all those in favor of the DE1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and the DE1 amendment is adopted. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Euland. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Joel Euland. I am the Public Policy Director for UCARE. UCARE is a health plan serving approximately 160,000 members in Minnesota. As many of you know, UCARE saw a significant change 14 months ago as a result of the managed care competitive bidding process. In December of 2015, we were serving 500,000 members. And in one day, on January 1st, 2016, we lost 350,000 of those members that we were serving through the PMAP and Minnesota Care contracts as a result of the competitive bidding process. After going through the available appeals process, we were able to continue to serve in Olmsted County, but lost the rest of the counties in our service area. The impact was dramatic, and it should be noted that in addition to the 350,000 members that UCARE was serving that needed to switch plans, an additional 100,000 members from the other health plans also needed to switch to other plans as well. UCARE organizational impact also required us to lay off 250 staff as a result of this. In the aftermath of these major changes, a number of legislators on both sides of the aisle came to us to talk about what had happened and what fixes could be recommended for the legislature to take a look at. House File 1739 is a result of the conversations with various legislators and our observations of the process and where it could be improved. Section A of the bill, and I am working off of the delete all, Section A of the bill clarifies that, first of all, DHS does have a choice on whether to use competitive bidding or not. If they do use competitive bidding, then what we would want to see is that it be done regionally and not statewide. We are seeking this in part because a statewide bid can easily have the effect of becoming a winner-takes-all situation. While there will still be winners and losers in a regional approach, the loss will not be as devastating for a health plan as a statewide bid would be. We've heard a number of legislators who want to have more competition in the state for the health plans. The reality is that it would be very difficult for a smaller health plan like mine to come back in and compete if you're not able to maintain at least a minimum infrastructure for serving these members. Section B clarifies the use and weighting of county board resolutions through the procurement process. Many counties spent extensive amounts of time providing their preferences to DHS for plan options in the counties, only to find out later that the board resolutions would be used only as a tiebreaker through that process. What we have in Section B clarifies the scoring weight so that the process is more transparent to all. Section C clarifies the use of best and final offer by respondents to the respondents of the RFP. Section D states that the commissioner shall consider network adequacy as part of the RFP process. Section E clarifies that during the period when the award determination is announced, but before contracts are signed, the health plans would be allowed to see our own scoring sheet and related information. We would not be able to see our competitors' information. One of the challenges that UCARE faced when we were considering appeal a year and a half ago to the DHS decision was it was very difficult for us to even understand if we even had grounds for an appeal, because we did not have the information to understand the underlying reason for why our plan had not been picked. This would just clarify that type of information. Section F sets out a process for appeals and how a health plan can appeal the decision of the commissioner by utilizing the contested case procedures. As we went through this process in 2015, we found that as a health plan, our appeal rights were limited and they were awkward. Our only recourse to appeal the decision of the commissioner was by asking counties to submit appeals on our behalf. Those county appeals would be brought to a three-person panel made up of representatives of counties and DHS. The panel then makes the recommendations to the commissioner, the same person who had made the original decision. UCARE acknowledges and appreciates that we were able to win back Homestead County in this appeals process in 2015. However, we still feel that the counties should not be put in a position of having to file appeals on behalf of health plans, and that the appealed decision should not be made by the same person who had made the original decision. That is why we are suggesting the contested case procedures in Section F. Section G creates an independent evaluation process for how competitive bidding would work and makes some suggested changes. We have met with the department to discuss the bill, and the amendment that is in the DE1 reflects some of those conversations. And we continue to acknowledge that this is a work in progress, but I would be happy to answer any questions that the committee may have.
All right. Are there any questions at the moment for Mr. Euland? Not seeing any. Mr. Euland, the committee thanks you for your testimony. Let's see. We have, and I cannot pronounce your name, Mr. Pizbilla?
Pizbilla.
Thank you. If you could please state your name slowly for us when you present, and then give us your testimony.
There's multiple ways. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Jim Pizzavilla. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Prime West Health,
located in Alexandria and serving 13 rural counties in west central, basically from Pipestone County up to the Canadian border. I also represent and speak for the Minnesota Association of County Health Plans. It comprises the county-based purchasing organizations that serve 26 counties and over 80,000 members enrolled in Minnesota health care programs. Thank you for the opportunity for me to speak today to you. While there are some aspects of House File 1739 that might have a positive effect on the Minnesota healthcare program's procurement process, it does not apply all the many lessons learned during the 2015 procurement and from the many procurements conducted over the last 15 years. I've been doing this since 2001, so I've seen quite a few of these, and they have been something to watch unfold over the years, and many things have been learned. I know and appreciate that the intent of this is to solve some of those problems, but we can't ignore that there were some good things that happened as well in the procurement. We want to preserve those. One of the first lessons I thought that was learned, and I hope we hold on to, is that it allows the commissioner to have discretion when to use competitive bidding. Right now the law has, or this bill has, the word may. If that's ever replaced with the word shall, then I'm afraid we'll be using a hammer when a hammer is not needed. Competitive bidding was in response to a widely held and publicized perception that the private health plans were profiting too much from taxpayer-supported public programs through excessively high reimbursement rates. We read about it often in the newspaper. It was often discussed here at the legislature. Competitive bidding worked in 2015. It worked. It applied classic competitive marketplace principles and got the private health plans themselves to lower their own reimbursement rates. But it may have worked too well. Whether by underestimating the health care costs of the populations they bid to serve, or by a desire to capture a greater market share through predatory lower bids, the health plans themselves set in motion a pendulum swing from excessively high reimbursement rates to now perhaps excessively inadequate. What evidence do we have of that? If we look back just over the last couple of months, it started out when Blue Plus, late last summer, early fall, announced losses in the public programs. It was followed by Medica announcing its departure from public programs. It was in yesterday's headlines when Children's terminated their contract with Blue Cross. That's all a result of the competitive bidding and where we find ourselves with reimbursement rates as a result of the bidding. But it worked. We brought the prices down. We brought our costs down. It was a dramatic rebasing of spiraling reimbursement rates that have taken place over the last decade. And it provided the baseline for a new DHS reimbursement rate setting methodology that we believe will eventually arrive at managed care rates that are neither excessive or inadequate. Leadership at DHS informed us that finding the tipping point was their goal. We believe them, we agree with that goal, and we think now the rate setting methodology is on the right course to get there. Enough to pay our providers adequately, not excessive at the taxpayer's expense. We have to keep the word may and allow the commissioner discretion and to use judgment when applying the hammer or not when it comes to fair pricing of what it costs to do managed care in the state of Minnesota. If we take out the word may and substitute the word shall, and I'm afraid of this as we go through the legislative process, health plans will basically likely arrive at two different results. One of two. Health plans will again try to capture market share by lowballing the bids, likely driving some of their competitors like Prime West out of business and leaving Minnesota with fewer competitors and fewer procurements. And moreover, where do you think they'll recoup their low bid? From providers. It also could produce something we don't want. The minute we go to competitive procurement again, what if the bids come in higher than our current rates? We might put ourselves on that same path that led us to the 2015 competitive bidding in the first place. The next lesson learned should be applied to the bill beginning on line 110 and the use of the numeral word number 4. This is actually a lesson that's twofold. four regions suggest that Minnesota has a fairly homogenous population need and determinants and fairly homogenous health care systems for addressing them. We all know that's not the case. If there were flaws in the 2015 competitive bid process and the rate-setting methodology, one might be that we use too few regions. A more population and health system-sensitive number would be six or seven. For example, Hennepin and Ramsey counties together and separate, or separate. Greater Twin Cities Metro, Olmsted County. Greater Minnesota Metro, rural northern counties, and rural southern counties. This would distinguish between those things that can influence the cost of health care and mask areas of high cost or low cost and not be accurately reflected in the rates that the health plans received to address and control costs. The number four also means one regional procurement for 4 years, one each year for 4 years over a five-year cycle. I've been doing these a long time, and that is nuts. That is nuts. Combine these annual procurements with the procurements for special needs basic care and Minnesota Senior Health Options and Minnesota Senior Care Plus, we could be doing two procurements in years. I cannot speak for DHS, but I have to imagine this is a huge administrative burden and a huge drain on the human resources each time they put together an RFP and put this out for procurement. I can speak as a managed care organization, albeit county-based purchasing, effectively responding to Minnesota healthcare programs, requests for proposals, and procurements takes Prime West's top people off the front lines and away from direct service to members or supporting providers that care for our members to basically write a proposal for 2 months or more. Further, you really cannot commit to any long-term strategic plans for improving quality, care outcomes, or controlling costs if every so often you can't bank that you're going to have the same service area 1 year from now that you had today. The lesson learned, we think, from this is keep it statewide. Conducted once only every 5 years as required, applying competitive bidding only as needed, and further maintain a robust mix of managed care organizations serving the state to protect against member disruption caused when one MCO that serves too big of a portion of the state, resulting from a previous procurement, fails to succeed in the next procurement. Part of our disruption was, at one time, UCARE was the predominant health plan when it came to Minnesota health care programs across the state. They were not successful in 2015. That set the fall. It was not the 2015 procurement. It was the procurement preceding that. We won't address the problems by simply moving on a regional approach. It's actually procured regionally on a statewide approach. DHS does not award swaths of the state. It looks by region. It looks by counties. And that's the result. Therefore, I think a regional approach to procurement that's done each year is a burdensome and costly approach to addressing a problem that really does not exist. There's one line that concerns us in particular as well. It's line starts on line 1.15 and allows for two plans in rural areas, or as it's stated here, non-metro. But that's already allowed in statute. There's nothing preventing two plants serving a rural area. What we're afraid of is that might be down the road misinterpreted as meaning there must be two plants serving a rural area. And we believe if that interpretation ever takes place, it would have a negative effect on rural providers and the growth of accountable care and value-based reimbursement in rural Minnesota. Federal law addresses this issue very knowledgeably. It basically states that the states can opt to have only one managed care plan to serve a rural county as long as that health plan offers a choice of providers in that county when an actual choice exists. And current Minnesota statute mirrors that. for the Fed and our current statute in rural areas, it's more about offering a choice of providers than choice of health plans. This acknowledges the health system realities of rural areas and the fact that in public programs, the health plans are pretty much supposed to do and offer the same things. One plan serving a rural area spares providers from having to understand, deal with, and comply with multiple public program payers' service authorization, contracting, and payment policies and procedures. It's a commonly expressed frustration by providers, metro or rural. You've heard it here at the legislature. I've seen it testified. The key is that the single player, if there is one, or a payer in a rural county, must be highly responsive to local needs, providers, and members alike, and not abuse what we think is a privilege and a rather awesome responsibility that comes with being a single payer in any one county. And when there is, we need to make sure that there's open communication when the community itself is frustrated in that situation, between DHS, the community, and the health plan, and providers alike. Further, the ability of having just one plan serving a county allows for accountable care and value-based reimbursement to improve health care quality and population health and reduce health care costs to take place in rural Minnesota. Accountable care and value-based reimbursement is only feasible and effective when a provider has a critical mass of Minnesota health care program patients. This cannot be achieved when the relatively small number of Minnesota health care program patients in a rural county are divided up among two or more health plans. Prime West is the only medical assistance and Minnesota health care program for medical assistance managed care plan in our 13 counties, which are all rural. And currently, we have over 60% of our members primarily receiving care that is provided or coordinated by Prime West accountable care providers. The number should increase to over 70% by 2018. In just 2 years, our two mature accountable care organizations serving fewer than 6,000 public program members have reduced health care spending by $2.5 million. These results would not be possible under a multi-payer system in any one of our 13 counties. Therefore, the Minnesota Association of County Health Plans strongly urges replacing the language in the line 1.15 through 1.17 pertaining to non-metro areas with the federal language pertaining to rural areas. Regarding the rest of the bill, given the members of MATCHUP, including Prime West, are owned by counties and governed by the counties, we can support language appearing in Section B. We believe that implying this, in part, the lesson learned here was when some counties, through their legislators, expressed much outcry regarding the results of procurements, a perceived lack of transparency, and a perceived lack of importance placed in the county's preferences during the decision-making process. We also support Section C. We believe this could result in maintaining a robust mix of health plans statewide. We also support Section D, and we have no problem with Section E as well. However, we entirely oppose Section F. That current statute language regarding the procurement appeal process and the language contained in the DHS bill that DHS is preparing includes a fair appeal process using a three-member panel. Prime West did not win one of those appeals, but we thought the process was fair. The procurement proposals, we believe, require reviewers to have a deep understanding of the Minnesota health care programs in order to truly process and comprehend what managed care organizations are doing and proposing to do. No administrative law judge can be expected to possess that level of understanding. Managed care organizations take months preparing a detailed proposal to make their best case. Using an administrative law process just invites into the equation the potential for the words of a clever spokesperson to outweigh the deeper arguments and the wealth of information contained in the proposal. It also allows for an expensive legal review, again, possibly rendering the value of an actual proposal secondary to clever legal argument. Further, DHS is the designated agency for Medicaid, and giving the administrative law judge final say in Medicaid procurement undermines the commissioner's designated authority. We believe if there's a lesson learned here, it is that county input in decision-making needs to be participative and taken under serious advisement, and then transparency is essential in order to avoid procurement decision conflict. I think it is important to keep in mind that one of MATCHUP's members, the South Country Health Alliance, which, like UCARE, stood to lose much of its business after the 2015 procurement, the CEO of South Country informed me that they are in opposition of this Section F as well, involving the administrative law judge and judicial review for much the same reasons I just described. Finally, I've only addressed the lessons learned or not learned as they appear in this bill. There are many more lessons that are absent in this bill's language by oversight or design, and what's excluded could create many unanticipated negative consequences. What's currently in statute and what is now being developed by DHS with the assistance and involvement of all the managed care organizations is a bill that we believe will thoroughly apply the lessons learned from the 2015 procurement and the procurement preceding it, more so than this particular bill. Moreover, one more of the advocates of 1739 are involved in with DHS in developing the bill, which addresses procurement and many other Medicaid and managed care issues. And I believe DHS will incorporate many of our suggestions into the bill. So therefore, the Minnesota Association of Counties encourages you to forego passing this bill and instead merge its best parts, and they are good parts, with the bill being developed by DHS in order to apply all the lessons learned from the many years of competitive procurement in the state of Minnesota. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Prisabilla, for your testimony this afternoon. Are there questions for the testifier, Representative Crescia?
Not for the testifier, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering if there's anyone from DHS that's going to respond.
I'm sure that DHS will have something to say, and we'll be sure to call them down when we get to that point. Thank you, Representative Crescia. Any questions for Mr. Prisabilla? Mr. Prisabilla, a couple of things. When you framed the argument, you talked about 2015 being the year that, and the procurement process that went into that, and the disruptions that came from there as being the kind of the precipice for where we're at today. But through this procurement process, even before that, we've been seeing disruptions anywhere between 10 and 30,000 users a year in 2013 and 2014. Is that were those for different reasons that Blue Cross and Medica over those 2 years up in the north and the metro area saw disruptions different than the procurement process that is in 2015, why were you framing just 2015? And
15 seemed to be the tipping point that I think led to this particular bill, and I may be wrong, Mr. Chairman. Keep in mind that prior to this, most of the Minnesota healthcare programs were procured on a regional basis, on a rotating basis. We've been there before. Statewide is a fairly new concept being applied. And regional actually produced the same kind of churn, if I may, that you just described. You will have that, I think. You have to expect that on a procurement. There's going to be a winner and loser, and it may not be the incumbent serving those counties. It's based on the merit of the proposal, of what they've achieved and what they're proposing to achieve. And I think that's how we stay competitive. Unfortunately, because we do have to procure to remain competitive, there will be changes, and I believe disruption therefore inevitable.
Are there any other questions for the testifier? Seeing none, Mr. Prisabilla, the committee thanks you for your testimony today.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, thank you very much.
All right, there was a request for DHS to testify on the bill, if they could make their way down. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Marie Zimmerman. I'm the Medicaid Director at the Department of Human Services. First, just let me say that we really appreciate UCARE being transparent in providing us this bill in advance and allowing us sort of the opportunity to provide feedback, as well as the author, Representative Zerwas, and the Senate author as well. And they did incorporate some of the feedback that we had based on some concerns that we have. We do still have some concerns with the bill, but as Mr. Ulan said, we understand this is a work in progress, and they're willing to still have discussions with us and work together. Maybe just as a little bit of background, the 2015, we used 2015, 2016. It was 2015 that we did the procurement. It was for calendar year 2016. So if I end up using those years interchangeably, I'm talking about the same year. But really that procurement was different from the perspective of there was a lot that we changed and made more robust about that procurement. It was the first procurement where we took public feedback in advance and incorporated it directly into the process and into the questions that we asked for. Since that time, we have had several productive conversations with the counties, since they're involved in the process, health plans, providers, all about, you know, lessons learned and possible improvements that could be made. The other thing I would mention just very briefly is that the OLA did review the 2015 procurement that we have and said in that process that DHS had a reasonable and inclusive process. But as I said, that doesn't mean there's not certainly room for improvement in our processes and the evaluation. One, in terms of alignment with the bill, I think we heard this directly from counties as well, that there was that the county board recommendation was sort of ambiguous and not part of the scoring methodology. So that's something where we actually sought feedback from the counties at the end of that year and had sort of raised that one as a potential issue of, yes, maybe that should be more formally incorporated into the scoring process so that part is at least clear and it's not sort of a subjective piece that's considered at the end. The other thing I would mention is that the department has been pretty open and sort of stated, I think pretty clearly to stakeholders, that we are looking to potentially go back to a regional basis. So the statewide procurement was a piece of legislation that passed. I think at the time there wasn't necessarily a lot of discussion about the potential impacts or magnitude of that. I think it didn't necessarily get a lot of conversation. But, you know, there is something to some efficiencies to doing that, although I will say it was also not an insignificant administrative burden to the department to do all 87 counties at one time. And part of that is just the fact that the counties actually are part of the review and scoring process. So meeting with those folks, getting their questions to incorporate, having everyone review, sort of coordinating all that is a lot to do on a statewide basis. So I think we appreciate that. And maybe one lesson learned, you know, if we could sort of go back, is we heard pretty strongly during the county mediation process that the counties that just went to through the 2014 competitive procurement, the 27 counties that Representative Zerwas mentioned, now sort of felt like they were just going through it back again in 2016. So, you know, if we had kind of been thinking about it at the time, maybe those counties should have been left out of the statewide bid because they had kind of just gone through that procurement and gone through that sort of, you know, disruption and change of plans. So I think we sort of recognize that and understand that it's hard, not just in terms of the number of regions that you procure at a time, but sort of the spacing between them as well when there is a change in plans that serve. That being said, just in terms of some additional concerns that we have around the bill, one of them is that there appears to be a little bit of a conflicting appeals process. So we have the county mediation panel, and then we have this new appeals process from the health plans, and it's not quite clear what happens if the recommendations of the two or the decision of the one and the recommendation of the other conflict for some reason. So I think that's a potential issue. I think it was mentioned by, it might have been Mr. Prisvilla, but it's just creating also a new set of processes and administrative procedures that we think will likely delay timely procurement. So when the department puts out a procurement, for example, when we did the statewide competitive bid, we put it out in January of 2015, and that was getting, of 2015, that was us getting feedback at the end of 2014, and we have to have open enrollment ready to go essentially by September, and we also have a new requirement from CMS to submit all the managed care contracts 90 days in advance of when they're effective, so that this year is October. So having a bunch of additional procedures in that could potentially delay who the health plan selections are, we think will sort of complicate that process. You know, the other thing is using sort of a single criteria of a metropolitan statistical area of determining the number of plans that serve in a particular area. Sometimes an MSA, particularly for a border community, is more on not the Minnesota side, but, you know, potentially the other in the other state. So we think other things like provider networks, shared provider networks, and other sort of regional aspects should be taken into consideration and not just whether or not somebody's part of an MSA. I think another thing is that this appears to be treating procurement for Medicaid sort of differently than it would be procurement for that the state does for any other services and sort of affording rights to health plans as contractors of the state that just don't, at least from what we understand, exist elsewhere. I can certainly be corrected on that. And then I think, as was mentioned, the administrative law judge appeals process, it's, you know, right now in the commissioner's authority to, you know, make the decision, and it's a qualitative decision, you know, in many aspects, that assuming that we have a fair and reasonable process to make that decision of who best to serve and contract for Medicaid managed care services. So that's sort of the sort of general concerns, and again, appreciate the fact that Representative Zerwas and also Mr. Ulan are sort of willing to continue to work with us.
Thank you, Ms. Zimmerman, for your testimony here. I have a couple of questions here for you. We talked a little bit about the number of people that were disrupted and the changes, especially from about 2013 to 2015 and on. Can you give us kind of an idea of the last few years, because the way we've been doing competitive bidding, just how many people have been disrupted from that?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to make guesses off the top of my head from what I recall, but I can certainly follow up with the committee. So in 2011, when we competitively bid the metro area, the seven-county metro area, I believe the number was somewhere around 80,000 folks that had to switch their health plans at that time. And then when we did the 27-county procurement in greater Minnesota, I believe that number was somewhere around between 40 and 50,000 that had to transition at that time as well from a change in plan.
Okay, and since that time, moving forward in more recent years?
Mr. Chair, the 2016 competitive bid was about 400,000 folks that had to change. And again, that was in part because we were doing all 87 counties at once, as opposed to, you know, previously just the metro area or just those 27 counties.
Okay, and were there any other big reasons for that one with the 400,000, since that's a little bit of a bigger number?
Mr. Chair, it was the change in plan. So as Mr. Ulan mentioned, a big part of that was UCARE, but it was also, for example, like health partners coming out of Hennepin County.
Okay. Any other questions for Ms. Zimmerman? Dueling questions, Representative Murphy.
Thanks. Thank you. And for Ms. Zimmerman, can you talk about disruption prior to competitive bidding, right? There was another way that you procured. Did the state or did MOAs experience the same kind of disruption that you're describing prior to the competitive bidding process?
Ms. Zimmerman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, certainly not of the same numbers. I mean, how the department used to do procurement prior to competitive bidding was we put out a procurement. Health plans had to respond, both HMOs and county-based purchasing plans. And if they met, it was more like if you met a minimum criteria, everybody was selected, and then the state set the rate for that. So it wasn't a competitive procurement from the perspective of somebody may not be let into a particular county. It was, so in some cases, we had upwards of five health plans in a single county, with overlapping provider networks providing the same program or product, essentially.
Representative Burke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I could just continue. You said that prior to the competitive bidding process, the health plans had to submit. Is that accurate, that they had to?
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, yes, it's part of their licensure requirements under 62D that they're required to submit a good faith proposal for public programs as part of their HMO licensure.
And Mr. Chair, does that continue now?
Ms. Zimmerman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, yes, it does.
Okay. And then can you just talk with me a little bit about the intervals of bidding? What guides that? When you decide to procure, we're hearing a little bit about the frequency of it and what the right number is. And I'm just wondering what guides your decision-making about when and what you think is the right interval.
Ms. Zimmerman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, prior to competitive bidding, and I would say even potentially now, what guides it in part is a state law requirement that you have to do procurement every 5 years. So you can do it earlier than 5 years. You could do it every year if you wanted to, but it's every 5 years. So that's what we had before. We had a schedule of a certain number of counties, and that was sort of on a rotating. So we were almost doing a procurement almost every single year. Sometimes it was a small number of counties. Sometimes it was a slightly larger number of counties. I wouldn't say there was necessarily a rhyme or reason other than how frequently they had been procured. And that's where we were in 2011 when we did the metro area. The metro area was just up on that five-year cycle. So it wasn't as though we just made that decision to do the metro for competitive bidding at that time. It just so happened that the metro area had been up at that time. The same is true for the 27 counties in 2014 as well. And then the statewide bid came as the result of legislation to do a statewide procurement.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you very much. So every 5 years for sure, but with more frequency if you choose.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Zimmerman.
And Representative Murphy, that's correct.
And can you just help us understand, thank you, Mr. Chair, what would be the factors that would drive a more frequent procurement than every 5 years?
Ms. Zimmerman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I think in part it is driven by feedback from the counties. They do play quite a significant role in doing the review with us. So, you know, we're not trying to make them do reviews all the time, so we certainly want to be mindful of administrative burden. And that's certainly true for DHS and for the, you know, for anybody who's submitting a proposal as well as sort of being in a perpetual procurement cycle. I think the other part of that is since we introduced competitive bidding that brings in a price component, I think that's not an insignificant task as well, and given that that can change who the health plan is, I think anything sort of less than 2 years, essentially. So that's what was originally said by our commissioner when we put out the statewide competitive bid, that in order to ensure some level of consistency and stability, that we said that would hold for a minimum of 2 years. And the department has said, now this one will be 3 because we have said we're not doing the procurement for 2018. We would have had to have already started that process at this point.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In this room, one of the things that I think was concerning with the last bid was the inability to review for an unsuccessful bidder to file some sort of a complaint or a review. So if it was not fair, that there was no possibility for review until after there was basically no ability to question that. So if you can't file for that until after it's too late, it's not as transparent and competitive as we would like it. And at the time, that did strike me as being odd and different from other competitive bid processes for public programs and for public projects. And I'm just wondering if the department is satisfied with the transparency that we now have and the ability to fix something, whether it's a mistake or if something is just not fair with the bidding process. And I have to say I was more aware of what it was after the fact than before the fact because of the subjective nature of many of the scores. Do you think we have the transparency that we currently need with this, or do you think that we need further transparency? How do you think this is going to work?
Ms. Zimmerman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dean, so in our conversations with UCARE about this provision and with Representative Zerwas as well, I think that we understood from UCARE that when we actually sat down and met with them, that they found that helpful and to sort of walk through what our review sort of entailed and why they weren't essentially awarded or why they didn't score as high, and that was valuable. So I don't think it's that we're opposed or don't think that level of transparency should occur. I think it more the challenge would be revealing detailed information about scoring that may reveal someone's ranking relative to other plans, or that that information may be used in a way in contract negotiations that may sort of limit the state's ability to negotiate the contract further. And I'm not talking about price even per se. I'm talking about areas of priority or concern of the department that we may want to see in the contract itself.
Jardine. Well, I think just one of the things that, I found about it, and in other areas of procurement from the state, is that the scoring mechanisms have become more subjective, and that if you have a weighting that is fuzzier, that the scorers can overcome price by subjective scores in other areas, so that you can, if you can get a B in eighth grade math, you can figure out how you can award a contract over a lowest price bidder by looking at the scoring mechanisms for subjective bidding. So that was one of the critiques that I had and continue to have about competitive bidding, is the subjective scoring really enables staff to drive scorers, I think, whether the legislators or staff. So I think that's something we need to get a handle on, not just for DHS, but for other projects. And then just lastly, about the time lag between bids, if you're an unsuccessful bidder and you lose half the market, then it seems very difficult, in the case of UCARE in particular, to say, well, I'll just come back and try it again in a few years, and your business is completely changed. So I think we did learn some things from that. 2 years ago, on the last budget, I asked the finance commissioner, you know, what about the governor's budget do you like the best? And the number one reform was competitive bidding in our public health care program. That was like the top reform. And since that time, of course, we've gone through this. So I think this is an area that we've got to probably some work to do before we get it right. And I'm certainly not satisfied with Representative Azarwas's awesome bill, notwithstanding. I think we've got a ways to go. My comments, Ms. Zimmerman.
Mr. Chair, I don't have any further comments. No.
All right. Ms. Zimmerman, I had a question about this last bit of procurement and some of the extra expenses with enhanced payments. And I was just wondering what the decision was for the enhanced payments and what the plan is in the future, if those are going to continue, what the policy is kind of around those.
Mr. Chair, can I clarify, are we referring to the most recent contract amendment that is the result of Medica withdrawing for 2017? Thank you. So, Mr. Chair, and I also maybe want to clarify, are we talking about the transition payments that occur for the Medica enrollees that have to make a new selection when they move May 1st?
Yes.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, those payments are one-time payments that are not part of the base rate, that are specifically, again, for Medica enrollees only, and they are Medica enrollees that have to be in April in Medica and then transition to another plan. And they essentially represent a couple of different things. One is the continuity of care costs and requirements. So if somebody has to be maintained when they transition on a particular drug that's not on a plan's formulary or a particular provider, for example. The other part of it is when, since the rates are still based on the plan's competitive bids from for 2016, part of those bids incorporated efficiencies and programs and initiatives that the health plans incorporated into their bids that would be lost for some period of time when a new person is transitioning. Those payments are only occurring for 4 of the 8 months of that transition, and again, are not part of the base rate, so they will not carry forward.
Okay, and what did the same process happen before, for instance, when UCARE was out of the system?
Mr. Chair, no, because that was part of a procurement process. So we assume when a plan goes in to bid, that they understand, particularly given the last two competitive bids, that there will be shifts in plans at the start of that. The situation is a little bit unique because we have a health plan that is withdrawing from a contract in the middle of a contract year.
Okay, and if a plan withdrew in the middle of a contract year and then wanted to re-procure under that, would that be allowed?
Mr. Chair, if you're asking if the health plan can come back in, a health plan that doesn't have a contract with us for 2017 cannot come back in for PMAP and Minnesota Care until the next procurement.
Okay, and that's by law for that, Ms. Zimmerman?
Mr. Chair, no, that it's they don't have a 2017 contract. So in between procurements, our contracts are on a one-year auto-renewing basis. So between procurements, if you have a contract, you have an option to renew. If somebody doesn't have a current contract, there's no option to renew into the next year.
Okay, and how much is planned to be paid out for these enhanced payments there?
Mr. Chair, I'd be dangerous off the top of my head, so I can follow up with that, but I want to say it's somewhere in the neighborhood of $22 million, but I would appreciate being able to follow up in writing if I could.
Absolutely. Are there any other questions for Ms. Zimmerman? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony here. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 1739? Seeing none, we will move to amendments. I have the A3 amendment. I will move the A3 amendment. Members, I think that if we're going to be moving forward with these reforms here, that I think we agree are going to make the system a little bit better here, that we can get the procurement system solidified, move it in a little bit sooner, and give more notice to people about the process. And so we have more stability in the process and move it forward, and I would ask for your support. Representative Zerwas.
Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Yulin might have a comment, and then I'll follow up after him.
Mr. Yulin.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would not support that amendment, and it's similar to the comments that Mr. Prisbillo was bringing forward. I think that especially in this era of uncertainty with what's going on both at the federal and state level in the Medicaid programs, I think we want to make sure that the commissioner has the maximum flexibility in this situation, and so we wouldn't support where they must do competitive bidding. We prefer that the language, as we've stated it here, says that they may utilize a competitive bidding program, and then if they do, then we kind of outline how the procedure would work.
Or could work under.
Could work.
Yes, but it doesn't necessarily have to. Representative Zerwas.
Mr. Chair, I respect Mr. Yulin is and who he's representing today. I think it would be beneficial to move forward with the A3 amendment at this time.
All right. Are there any questions to the A3 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A3 amendment signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign.
No.
The A3 amendment is adopted. With that, I had the A4 amendment. I am not going to offer the A4 amendment at this time. Are there any questions to the bill author? Seeing none, final word, Representative Zerwas.
Mr. Chair and members, as Ms. Zimmerman mentioned, we continue to work very closely with the department on this bill. I am no stranger to the imagination. Brought what I believe is the final product or a perfect bill or resolution to the committee today. It's definitely a work in progress. The DE1 amendment reflects a lot of work that Mr. Yulin and UCARE have done in cooperation with the department. I assume that work will continue into the future. I will say that in my meetings with the department, they have indicated a high likelihood of doing another round of competitive bidding in 2019. And so while that may seem a ways off, competitive bidding in 2019 means that the process will need to start in 2018, which means if we're going to have any modifications or set up new guardrails for that process, that does have to occur this session, and that's why I encourage the bill to move forward and our discussions with the department to continue.
With that, I'll renew my motion that House File 1739, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 1739, as amended, is referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Thank you, members. That concludes our work for this week. We are adjourned.